see the order for Monday, February 18th. Got a very full agenda, as you can see. The University of Oregon's arena project is not on the agenda, contrary to what the papers would like us to believe. As you can see, we've got capital construction bill dealing with transportation and aviation. We've got a budget reconciliation dealing with aviation and Oregon Health Partnerships. And we have a lot of people I know that are very interested in the rural regional board discussion. We've been unable to give them extra time. This is the only time, unfortunately, in our brief session here that we'll be able to address that, along with the infrastructure, inventory activity work that they've done for us over the last biennium, basically, and I want to honor that commitment we've made to these guys. We have one bill we'll be passing out, hopefully. That's the mortgage loan bill. And then we've got two informational meetings on Department of Transportation and one on clinical social workers. So we've got a lot to do today. I think the final budget bills, hopefully, and you want to stay posted, again, check here at the Capitol, will be either on Wednesday or Thursday. And that'll be our budget reconciliation bills. I have all the information that we're talking about here and been talking about in Ways and Means in both December and January. And then we'll come in here, and if there's any topic you want to talk about, we'll try and make some time so that everyone gets a chance to be heard. So let's entertain the public testimony for at least a half an hour on the items that I just outlined that are here before us today. We've got... That's not right. About Nikki Whitty and Judge Steve, I'm not going to get the last name right.
Grassley.
I apologize. And Peggy Gates, I believe. Thank you for making the sojourn. Yeah, we'll probably give about 20 minutes each so we can get through everybody that wants to talk, please.
Thank you, co-chairs and members. My name is Nikki Whitty. I'm a county commissioner in Coos County. And for 6 years prior to becoming a county commissioner, I was the manager of this program in the Coos Curry Douglas region. So I've really seen it evolve over time. And I think the changes that you made maybe two sessions ago, where our region at least is very concerned and spends our money on job creation projects, and I hope we've made you proud of the program in our region. And I'm proud to say that when we went through the priority process for your needs and issues, Senator Verger got to see most of it, and I think she saw a region that works very well together. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Schrader and members of the committee. I do have two handouts. So I won't read that. I'll try and encapsulate it here. But for the record, I'm Steve Grassley. I chair the Southeast Regional Alliance, which is the Regional Investment Board for Malheur, Grant, and Harney counties. I'm also the Harney County Court Judge, and I'm the second Vice President of the Association of Oregon Counties. And I am here today to speak in support of immediately providing funding to the regional investment boards. And my rationale really comes from three areas. One's leverage. Over the last 4 years, we've taken about $1 million and leveraged it with $13.4 million from other sources to bring us forward. We've also taken a very limited human capacity that we got out there and brought the private sector to the table in making these funding decisions out of the investment board. And one of the struggles for us has been that those people today, in particular the private sector folks, as they ask us, where are we going with these rural investment boards? They ask questions like, what's our role on the boards if we have no funds? Why do we spend our time? Why would we spend our time with no ability to participate in producing outcomes? Is there no recognition of our past successes? What are the tools left for us to use? And why does the state keep taking these tools away from us? And it's, those are all questions that I would love to have some help in answering, in particular the private sector folks and their time commitment to us. And third is long-term benefits of the state. We can see 337 jobs created, and even if you take our low per capita income average and multiply that times the 337, we've paid back to and state income tax the money, the lottery funds that are used. It seems like a pretty good return on investment. Most of those jobs are going to continue. One real quick success story is that we put $30,000 into our largest employer, a multi-million dollar corporation that probably could have gotten by without that money. But it was that commitment from the community that kept them there. They produced another 20 and 25 jobs since that time, and they are still there. They did make the decision to close another plant. Just know that the Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon Economic Development Association, and many of the rural investment boards around the state asked for the reinstatement of this valuable tool. It has, and it will continue to pay its own way. Thank you.
Chair Schroeder and Chair Nolan, my name is Peggy Yates. I'm an Economic Development Policy Advisor for Multnomah County Chair Ted Wheeler, and I'm here in support of ongoing funding for the Regional Investment Boards. It is our perspective that the value of those dollars in the last two years, 2005-2007, was $700,000 put into our communities, and this not just is in downtown Portland, but we're also seeing it in our rural communities in East County, that those $700,000 resulted in over 420 new jobs in our community, as well as an additional $7.1 million of private investment. Those dollars were vital in leveraging local community investment in our jobs and in our new businesses. I think a critical piece of this is our Regional Investment Board is extremely effective in being able to go in, take a look at a viable business. We're not talking about businesses that are not viable. They have a good working business plan. They have the capability. They just need that extra hump to get over that hurdle. We are not giving money out willy-nilly. Those dollars are done in conjunction with those individuals putting in equity into, from their own business into that community, as well as their need to be able to create new jobs. If they don't create new jobs, those dollars have to be paid back to the taxpayers. All those mechanisms are extremely vital in helping these small businesses, but for these fundings may not make that extra jump that's necessary for long-term growth. My concern in cutting back or eliminating this program is it's something you're not only going to see a different short-term with these small businesses, not creating 3 or 10 or 15 or 40 jobs, but these are the very businesses that are going to, in essence, in another 5 to 10 years, are the ones that are going to really result in big changes. They're the ones that are going to be employing our local community people. It's not, you know, the big businesses continue to, we see a lot of out-migration. There's not as much loyalty, but when you take a homegrown business in your community, they are committed to that community long-term. And just for an example, I will use a couple that are not necessarily regional investment boards, but I know were a result of creative financing. And we can't overlook that Nike was selling shoes out of the back of their car, and if not for some creative financing, would not be operating the operation they have now. NTEC in Lebanon. NTEC is another one that started in a garage, moved into their facility, needed a little extra creative financing. It's this sort of but-for funding, this little bit of funding gap, we're not talking big dollars, have a huge impact in our communities, and especially in Multnomah County, in our rural community, and as well as Washington. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Good testimony. Thank you. All right, let's get Renata Mecklenburg, Roy J., and Bill Fashing, I think.
Yeah.
don't you start in?
Honorable Co-Chairs Schrader and Nolan and members of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm the president of the Oregon Economic Development Association, representing economic development leaders from throughout the state, and I'm a business economic development coordinator for Clackamas County for 18 years. I urge you to allocate $5 million toward the continued funding of the regional investment program through the 2009 session. Our organization has passed a resolution to that effect that you're getting copies of now. As we lead into an economic downturn, it's even more critical to continue funding a successful program. Economic development is an investment that brings in new revenue to the state at a time when state revenues are not meeting projected forecasts. The regional investment program can provide an economic stimulus at a regional level for business recruitment, retention, marketing, and industrial land readiness. It is one of the few flexible sources of funding available. It provides modest gap grant and loan funding to businesses and communities that's a valued tool in rural areas and urban areas alike. Most counties and cities do not have alternative funding for economic development initiatives since they're grappling with budget shortfalls, basic service gaps, and reduced revenue at the state and federal level. Regional investment boards are key partners that provide significant expertise on the economic needs and unique opportunities in their areas. They were instrumental in developing the infrastructure analysis that quantifies significant investment needs statewide. These boards are in the best position to determine what investments will move key economic initiatives forward. Lack of continued funding for this program will lose the collective knowledge and wisdom of 210 local board members. I'm providing also a summary of great success stories in my region, the Mount Hood Economic Alliance. In this region alone, over the past 2 years, these funds have helped create 57 jobs, retain 60 jobs, and leverage $3.3 million in other investment. This is a return of one job for $5,000 invested, or $5 for every $1 in state funds. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Very good. Thank you, ma'am. Well, Jay, be sure up there.
Good afternoon. Chair Schrader and legislators, my name is Roy Jay, and I'm the chair of the Washington and Multnomah County Regional Investment Board, and I'm here to echo the same information that has already been set in front of you. I'm here to ask for your support for the ongoing funding of the Regional Investment Boards through OECDD. Our story is no different than any of the rest of the regions. We've been successful in helping to grow small business, maintain small business. We've created over our past several years, we've been able to help create 400-plus jobs that normally would have not possibly even left our region at this particular point. But as she was so elegantly put, we can't afford to lose any jobs here in Oregon. We can't afford to lose businesses in our state, especially seeing that we're going through some real critical times. I would hope that you would continue. I realize you have a big job ahead of you with budgets and things of that nature, but if we don't maintain and help support these small businesses, especially in our rural areas of Portland and in Washington County, not to mention all the rest of the state, then we all wind up losing. These people right now, they're paying taxes, they're employing people, and this is probably one of the best programs that we've been involved with. And as many of you know, we are all volunteers serving for the good of our city and our region and our state, and I ask that you continue the support of this $5 million that we critically need in order for us to move forward. So just like everybody else, I'll be glad to answer questions and brag about the region, but we're all on the same team here. We need to try and keep these jobs here, and at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, are you doing the very best to make sure that we ensure the future for small businesses throughout our state? Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Bill Fashion, Hood River County. Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm a past president of the Oregon Economic Development Association, and my current job is economic development coordinator for Hood River County. I have been actively involved in the Mount Hood Economic Alliance since I arrived in that job 5.5 years ago. Moving to Oregon and having an organization like this was probably the best economic development tool I've ever had in my 20 years of economic development experience, 25 now, in several different states. And I just am here, and I won't hit all the same points, but this is an important program for local economic development. We greatly need the support of this group. and I would be glad to answer questions, and I'll stop there.
Very good. Very good. Good testimony again.
Good.
Okay. Let's study together. Good job. Let's switch gears for a moment. Let's get Steve Emery up, John McCulley up, and Corey Streisinger up, please. Talk about Senate Bill 1064. Missing one, but it's okay. Please, gentlemen, go ahead.
Sure.
There we go. There's Corey.
We probably should have Corey go first.
Oh, that would be fine. Poor woman runs in here, you make her go first.
Well, also, he knows what this bill does.
Ah.
Thank you. And again, my apologies. I do have some materials. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today in support of Senate Bill 1064. This is one of two bills that came out of the governor's work group on mortgage lending. Mortgage lending is a topic we have all heard quite a bit about recently, and there are many, many issues that need to be addressed, whether in this session or later on. But the two bills that come forward, one of them deals with mortgage rescue types of situations. That's just passed the House, I believe, yesterday. And this bill deals with loan originators and enforcement. And just as a little bit of background, the loan originators are the sales force. Those are the people who sit across the table from you and actually talk to the borrower about the terms of a loan. They take the borrower's application, they qualify the borrowers for the loan, and they help the borrower select which loan to take. The number of loan originators registered with us rose from 9,000 in 2002 to a peak of about 14,000 in 2005, and with the drop-off in the lending market, it has dropped to about 8,800 as of December 2007, a drop of about 33%. And with this dramatic rise and fall, we have also seen an upswing in the number of complaints. Now, we license Oregon mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. Individual loan originators work for one of those licensed entities. We do not individually license them. We expect the licensees to supervise and oversee them. Mortgage lenders are required to register their loan originators with us, to check loan originators' criminal history, to ensure that loan originators obtain basic education and pass a qualifying exam. And in 2006, we tightened up our rules in that regard to make sure that the education and exam took place before the loan originator started working in the lending activity. It used to be a six-month grace period. One of the challenges we face in regulating in this area is our inability to keep bad loan originators out of the business, loan originators who don't adhere to the law. In other words, we don't currently have the means to suspend them or bar them from the industry. We can sanction the licensed mortgage broker. They may fire that loan originator. The loan originator can then go to work for somebody else. So this bill will allow the department to suspend or bar a loan originator from working for an Oregon mortgage broker or a mortgage banker if the loan originator has violated the law, been incompetent or dishonest, or failed to account for money received, or so on. And we do see those situations on an unfortunately regular basis. Enforcement would be subject to the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act. The bill also puts in statute the registry system. We do currently have a registry. This would put it in statute and strengthen it so that consumers would be able to check the history of a loan originator, and also a mortgage lender would be able to check the history of people who they are planning to hire.
Can I get you to summarize this?
That is essentially the subject of the bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. The request is for two FTE to enhance enforcement in this area, a compliance specialist and an enforcement staff person. The positions would be funded through fee revenue and through existing fee revenue. We anticipate that our existing fee revenue would be sufficient to fund these positions through 2011. After that, a fee increase would be required if we are to maintain the positions. We believe the bill has strong support from consumers and industry alike. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Excellent job. Gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley, representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. We, too, are here to support Senate Bill 1064. It has, as Ms. Reitinger said, broad support in the lending community. All of the lending community do support this bill. This has been an issue that our organization has been really striving for since 2001, when we were, with, of course, your help, able to pass a bill that required the continuing education, that required the testing. As a part of that original bill in 2001, we were seeking licensing of loan originators, and that did not pass. We had another bill last session that did not pass. Our desire was to find those bad actors and get them out of the business. We think that if you regulate people who are causing problems, you will really address some of the issues consumers are facing with problems in this area. We see it as people as more important than product when it comes to regulation in this area. So we support Senate Bill 1064. We strongly support the two positions in the department to provide more enforcement, and we urge your positive action on this bill.
Good, thank you.
Excuse me, hi, for the record, I'm Steve Emery. I'm an owner, I'm a licensee through the department, and own a mortgage brokerage company, and I also chaired Ethics Committee from 1998-99 through 2003 for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. I'm not representing that organization, John is, but I just strongly want to ditto everything that Corey said, support 1064. In fact, I'd love to see four or six more new positions in that department, but I strongly support it and love it.
Well, very good. We're in agreement then. That's good. We'll see if we're in agreement up here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Last person we had sign up for the items on our agenda today was Ron Fox. Ron Fox.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Schrader and Nolan, for the and legislators. My name is Ron Fox. I'm Executive Director of Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development, covering Jackson and Josephine counties. I'm here today to encourage your consideration for the request for continued funding for the Regional Strategies Program, the Regional Rural Investment Program. In the last biennium period, our Regional Investment Board, made up of volunteers appointed by the county commissioners, have directed the majority of that fund to the issue that we have struggled with most immediately in our region, which is a gap between the skilled workforce needed to support our growing industries and the capacity of those workers to fill those jobs. We believe that continuing the funding is essential. That job is not done, and we represent an opportunity to continue that investment with your support and encourage that consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Is there getting near the end of our public comment period? Is there anyone else that didn't sign up that wants to talk about some of the agenda items here today? Please come forward.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes,
sir. I understand that the bond, well, the bonding for the University of Oregon Arena is not specifically on our agenda, but I think there were a few people in the audience who, in all good faith, read the agenda because it said capital construction and thought this was their opportunity to testify. Some of them have traveled, not from my district, but from 50 to a couple hundred miles to be here, and I think it would be worth our giving them 2 minutes to testify.
Maybe at the end of our agenda today. I'm willing to stay and listen to people that would have come that far. I think that would be fine. But I think for the deference of the members of the committee, we should probably get through the stuff that's on the agenda here right now. Ms. Finney, please go ahead.
My name is Ellen Pinney. I'm the health policy advocate for the Oregon Health Action Campaign. I'd briefly like to reference Budget Reconciliation Bill, Senate Bill 5556, in regards to the Office of Private Health Partnerships. For those of you who don't know, there's over 60,000 people on the waiting list for the Oregon Health Plan Standard. Many of you probably know that when we closed that program, about 100,000 people lost coverage. Some of them, the ones that were able to navigate the reapplication application process and were able to afford out-of-pocket costs for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, we're able to get into that program. Today, because of CMS new rules, we no longer have the federal match that we thought we had for that program, and the Office of Private Health Partnerships is proposing to move some portion of their population into standard. We were very concerned about this until we understood that that movement will in no way jeopardize the luck of the people who have their name on that list. It is something that which would be very important to us. 60,000 people signed up hoping that their names could be drawn, and we would not want in any way to delay the opportunity for their name to be drawn or to change the luck of the draw, as it were, by bumping a whole lot of folks who currently have coverage up in front of them. But that's not the way this proposal is being presented to you. I would just like to say that it's curious to me that Standard, as you know now, is funded through a combination of hospital assessments and assessments on Medicaid managed care plans. And the plans that are now losing their enrollees, private insurers, are not contributing at this point anything to the Oregon Health Plan in terms of a managed care assessment. The ability of our state to assess Medicaid managed care plans ends in 2009, and I think that this is just one of the pieces that gives fuel to what I hope you will consider in the future, which is to assess all managed care plans in Oregon some contribution in order to support Standard and Family Health Insurance Assistance Program enrollment. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you very much. Anyone else on the items before us today? See, now let's stop the public hearing for a moment.
Mr. Chair, could we be at ease just for a moment?
I have an idea.
Thank you.
Well, stand at ease. Joint Ways and Means meeting for February 18th, back to order. And my colleagues are interested in getting all the public testimony done early rather than later. So we'll go ahead and reopen public testimony for at least University of Oregon stuff and perhaps anything else anyone is interested in talking about for a while. So we've got some people signed up. Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Storley, and Gary Niss, I think. Please come forward. Please, if you can keep it to 3 or 4 minutes, that would be great.
Yes, sir. I do have a handout, by the way. Who do I? Co-Chair Schrader and Co-Chair Nolan and members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity, and I would like to say an extra thank you since we found out it wasn't on and you're allowing us to speak. I do appreciate that. I signed in today. I'm Gary J. Niss from Beaverton, Washington County, and I signed in today as neutral on the University of Oregon bonds. And as I speak, I think I'll explain why I went that way. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak. First, I'd like to tell this audience that I am a sports fan and personally believe that a new basketball arena for the U of O is due and could be nice. I'm here on my own representing no group or association, but to voice my concern for safeguarding of our state's general funds by avoiding a pitfall of $200 million bond for the arena. While trying to follow very closely this issue, I see we are using different terms for the same pot of money. Pledges, gifts, donation, and legacy fund. The fund is to be used for different venues and manners. My source, the Oregonian, will pay bonds with area revenues or annual donations to the athletic department. Replace money in operations budgets with those proceeds from the legacy fund. The fund is the key assurance to legislature's bond to be paid. In another source, it said it will help support all athletic programs. I refer to this simply as dipping out of the same well with different buckets. There was a headline in the Oregonian said, University of Oregon Arena Key to $100 million gift. A gift is not a gift if it has stipulations and deadlines. It is an offer, a challenge, or a compromise. In preparing a presentation for you today, I found myself having to leave portions of this topic and the arena project aside, though they were still unanswered. You legislators have the same consideration, only magnified about 10 times, where things are not quite answered, you're not quite to the bottom, and I believe that's important. To approve during this special session would be a recipe for disaster. As far as safeguarding and protecting Oregon and its taxpayers from having to pay out of its general fund at some time prior to the bond's 30-year retirement, we must remember there is not $100 million in an established fund, and the $20 million stipends will be completed by 2012, while the debt goes to 2038. History has proven that rushed decisions are often regretted. While the arena project still should be pursued, there are still too many unanswered questions and facts. There are terms that need to be more adequately defined and state protections guaranteed, discussed, and more closely scrutinized before considering approving the arena during this special session. I would like to close by saying that if there is one scintilla of doubt regarding a fact or an unanswered question, it should be put aside of this busy special session and readdressed later. We citizens of the state trust you legislators to be the gatekeeper of funds and risks involved. Please continue to garner our respect by placing a hold on this high-dollar bond until we have guaranteed legally binding contract for the 30 years. This is only fair to you and the rest of the citizens of the state. I thank you for your time on this matter, and I would field any questions that you have at this time.
Thank you very much. Let's see, there was a Mr. Storley and a Mr. Dreyfus, I believe.
Thank you for letting me talk today. I come to you to speak for 33,000 families.
You probably need to identify yourself for the record. I'm sorry to interrupt. You need to identify yourself for the record, your name.
Okay.
You
don't. I'm Robert Storley. I'm from Bend, Oregon.
Thank you.
I'm a grandparent, a parent, a taxpayer, a U of O alumni, a wrestling alumni, and a donor to the University of Oregon. I respect the comments that he just made. I signed on as neutral also. I think that this $200 million loan, I'm a financial advisor and a loan officer for UBS Penn Weber, the largest bank in the world, and I think there should be considerations here on the character of the people that are requesting the loan and the objections and who the winners are if you make this loan and who the losers are. And the losers, the way it's currently structured, are going to be 33,000 families and their children that are involved in the sport of wrestling. We've been challenged on those numbers, but I want to give you a couple of facts. The last 3 days at the Memorial Coliseum, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 33,396 fans paid and bought tickets to watch over 3,000 kids and their coaches participate. January 11th, 12th, and 13th at the Redmond Fairgrounds, we had over 20,000 paid fans, 3,000 wrestlers. The sport is growing. It's the fastest growing sport in the state. And under the new plans from the athletic director, even though there was a promise from the president to part of the architecture was a new wrestling facility, they've eliminated that. and they want to cut the sport, a business decision. I respect Mr. Phil Kenny as a businessman and a donor, and Phil Knight's gifts are from his heart. I can't say enough about what he's done for the state of Oregon. So I would not want anything I say misread as negative about those two individuals. But I think these kids and your challenge is to provide opportunities, educational opportunities, and scholarships. We get 28 scholarships in the state for 6,000 high school wrestlers. And the good things that the sport contributes and gives back to the state in places like Burns, Irigon, Hermiston, Culver, Crater, places that most Oregonians don't even know exist. These kids work hard and they deserve scholarships. We have raised in the last less than 90 days $2.3 million, and we're in the first inning. So we're going to pay for a new wrestling facility to be built. 100%. We're going to pay the operating budget. We have the money, the pledges, however you want to measure it, ready to go. We're going to raise $6.8 million, and it's not a big issue. So the university, and you can look at what Pat Kilkenny's doing here. The business decision has actually caused a revenue-negative sport to step up with new donors and fund our own program. So you can look at that negative. I look at it positive. I think part of the covenants of this loan should be that the other 16 revenue-negative sports, men's and women's, have to follow the lead that the wrestling alumni and the wrestling family have demonstrated and fund their own sports. That will allow the
university... We'll probably need you to summarize your arguments.
Okay, to pay back the taxpayers, we need this arena, Lane County, the University of Oregon. It's a positive. But we also need to continue to give educational opportunities for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dreyfus.
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Dreyfus left a handwritten note that I will make sure that the staff copies and distributes to the members of the committee, since apparently he thought he wasn't going to get a chance to testify.
Very good. Very good. Anyone else want to testify on the University of Oregon Arena Project? The Oregonian circulation is broad as we thought it was. All right, well, let's now, if it's okay with the members, we'll stop the public hearing process and go to work session on Senate Bill 5555. Capital Construction, Department of Transportation, come on down.
Chair Schrader, Chair Nolan, thanks for the opportunity to come back and talk to you today. And members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to come back and talk to you this afternoon. I understand that a packet that I'm going to cover was distributed already, and I know you're fighting a time constraint, so I will move quickly, and please stop me with any questions. We're back talking about the Sisters Maintenance Station portion. We did this before, and there were a number of questions that came up that I wasn't prepared to address. I apologize for that. And so I'm going to move quickly through this. Again, the context is the Forest Service, you're on Forest Service land today. That permit to be on that land is going away. The Forest Service is selling the land. What I didn't emphasize enough in the first time I talked to you was that we have not decided on the final location yet. We are looking at several options. The best option for us is if we're able to co-locate with both the Forest Service and the Oregon Department of Forestry. We don't know if that's going to be possible because we don't know today all of the acreage demands and sites that are available. So we recognize that we don't know that, and we recognize that we may have the funds, and funds are likely to be unscheduled, and that's just fine with us. We just need to know that we've got the authority when we do make the final determination as to exactly what facility we will be on. So that's the situation. Slides 3 through 7 talk about the highways that are maintained out of the Sisters Maintenance Station, including information on the volumes of traffic and the number of crashes. I'll start to summarize by saying that these are significant highways to the state of Oregon, major highways, and unfortunately crashes that occur more often than we have to respond to that occur more often than we'd like. In looking at this, our conclusion was, given that it's in a winter area, given that we have this amount of traffic and unfortunately crashes, Bend and Redmond put us at a distance too far away to be able to respond adequately in a timely manner to make sure that we could keep those roads open and safe. On slides 8 and 9, we talk about the alternatives that we looked at. We looked at a number of alternatives. We did look at going to Bend. We did look at going to Redmond. We don't have a facility there, but we looked at that as another possibility. But again, determined that those were probably too far out of away from Sisters to give us the timely response that we felt that we needed. Slides 10 and 12. We talk about the reason that we believe that Sisters is the most appropriate area. It talks about the difference in response time. And also note on page 10, one issue that made some of the press, I think, was that we do recognize that we own a site close to Sisters, about 20 acres. It's a quarry site. Currently, that is a possibility for a location of a maintenance facility. But again, we haven't determined the final site. So that's still out there. It's still in play. If I portrayed that we were trying to hide that and wanted something else, that is totally incorrect. There's nothing, no reason for us to hide it. It's just a possible site that's out there among all the other possible sites. The remainder of the presentation talks about the basic needs of a maintenance compound and shows the type of equipment that must be serviced literally between 12-hour shifts during the winter season. We are 24/7 running all the time, and this equipment comes in caked with snow and ice, and we need to service it fast to get it back out onto the roadway. And that's why we are more efficient performing that type of service in a heated facility. On slide 18, one of the questions was about the typical cost of a maintenance station. We show a couple other examples of maintenance stations in that area. And note that while we could reduce those costs some, we would not totally replace those costs, even if we co-located with our facility in Bend. So, co-chairs, committee, I hope I have cleared up the questions that arose. And again, my apologies for not having this at my fingertips when I did the original presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
You should identify yourself for the record first.
Jeez. You'd think I'd know that after all these years. Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Transportation.
Thank you very much. Questions from Mr. Kendall, Senator Berger, and Senator Whitson?
Yes, Mr. Kendall, on slide 9, you have the first long-term alternative as to co-locate with the city of Sisters Public Works. You passed over that, and I'm wondering, does that require a property and a new building, or is that something that's already there that would be expanded?
Commissioner Schrader, Senator Berger, that is a possibility, either in the same location that they're at now or at another site that we would agree to move to. Again, that is still on the table in terms of consideration because it is in the Sisters area. So we have not ruled that out if we can find a site that that brings us the capability of co-locating with them and still being able to provide service to our highways.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader. Mr. Tingle, on your operating expenses, you show the sister station at about $25,000 a year. That's about one half FTE at $20 an hour. I don't really understand how that can be the operating cost. Can you tell us what is included in the operating costs, sir?
I'm sorry, Co-Chair Schrader, Senator Whitson. This is the would be the power, the utilities. When we get operating costs, it's not the cost of the complete crew and all the equipment there. This is the actual cost of the facilities themselves, the care and feeding of the landscape and the power and so forth. The cost of a crew is around, and this is a gross generalization, but it's around counting equipment, materials, and everything, around $4 or $5 million a year. And again, we're not going to change. If we co-locate with in band, we would have the same equipment and the same people.
Thank you.
More questions? Yes, Representative Hanna.
Well, actually, I'd like LFO to respond. I just want to make sure I understand. The money to be unscheduled is the $3,399, correct?
That's correct.
And I think I read in the material, 65% of that money is for the actual building of a structure. So,
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation is not to give the agency the full $6.9 million that they requested. The recommendation is to only give them $3.9 and to unschedule that $3.9 until they make a decision on what parcel of land they are going to acquire, what the cost is going to be, and if they choose find that they can lease property with one of their other partners in the area, they wouldn't have to spend that amount of money on the lease. That might then become their expenditure limitation for actually building the building that they would need to co-locate there. So until some of that uncertainty has been made some decisions, I'm not recommending the full amount.
Okay, just a brief follow-up. Does that fit as well if the 20-acre site that they currently own would be rezoned?
Correct. Yes.
So if they got that rezoned, the 3.3 would cover the cost of the building?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, until the agency actually does a cost estimate for the actual project, we won't know. And they can't tell us what it's going to cost until they know where their buildings are going to be located.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes, Co-Chair Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't know exactly how to form this question because I understand this is a capital project, but in the context of the overall budget for ODOT, I'm concerned about where this might fit in priorities against, for example, the reduced funding that the department is proposing for county distributions. I have a hard time prioritizing this project above those distributions, and I'd like comment from the department.
General, when the commission laid out their programmatic allotment of funds, which considered the $56 million allocation of the counties, they did identify funds in our program budget. So it comes from, it does not impact that the $56 million that's going to the counties. It was planned for along with that $56 million that was going to the counties. And so it is a overall prioritization of the entire budget to carve this much money out of the budget. It does, again, it does not impair that $56 million. I missed the question.
No, I think you got the question. I just suspect that the counties might have a different perspective on that. But I don't know that you can answer the question for them. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Further questions for the department? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion at the bottom of the memorandum from LFO on Senate Bill 5555. Unless there's more questions for the Department of Transportation.
There are not, Mr. Church. I was doing the final bill.
That's fine. All right. And we'll entertain the motion. Then I need someone to make a motion. Please. Something to the effect of the legislative fiscal office recommends the joint ways and means approve a motion to amend Senate Bill 5555 to reflect increase in other funds expenditure limitation of $3,399,999 for the Sisters Maintenance Station. With the understanding the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the funds until ODOT demonstrates the need to expend the funds. And thank you, Senator Winters, for moving that.
Mr. Chair, our team players.
More discussion, please.
I assured Mr. Tindall that I had had a rabies shot since the last time that we had this conversation, and I believe that the missing 22 acres has been found in Sisters. For that, I am very gratified and appreciative.
All right. Very good. Further discussion. Let's see. Bam, do you have some comments, please?
Co-Chair Schrader, Co-Chair Nolan, members of the committee. My name is Tamara Brickman with BAM, Budget and Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend you increase the other fund expenditure in Highway Division $3.4 million with the understanding that DAS will unschedule the funds until ODOT demonstrates the need to expend them.
Chair, I have no further comments.
Very good. That's where it's still for thunder, too.
No.
Further discussion? Yes, Senator Berger, please.
Chair, I guess I need some clarification. I'm just listening to the conversation. They don't know where it's going to be, and they aren't sure of how much it's going to cost. Now, did I miss something?
That's why everyone jumped up for the amendment.
And I believe the request, and Mr. Kennedy, you correct me if I'm wrong, is to use some money to find out how to answer both those two questions.
No, it's not scheduled to do that.
Come forward with a proposal, obviously. Mr. Tindall, do you want to court?
Chair Schrader, Senator Berger, what we need is if we determine that we have to negotiate for property, or if we determine that in order to purchase property, or if we determine that there are costs associated with moving onto our own property, there are some there will be some issues moving onto a site that's zoned as a quarry site. We need to know that we have the money and the capital construction limitation to do that, and that's and when we know what it is exactly we were doing, we will go to the Department of Administrative Services and we'll present that plan and ask them to schedule those monies that we are asking for your approval today.
Chair, just to follow up, so would that decision be made solely at the e-board level? That if they come back, it would be at the e-board?
Chair, Senator Berger, no, they don't need to come back to the emergency board to have those funds unscheduled. They only need to request that through the Department of Administrative Services. The agency has a range of costs that they estimated that the land is going to cost and a range for what the building and land will cost. But because they don't know where they are locating that facility, they can't give us a detailed cost estimate. So that is the reason why I am recommending that we give them enough money to allow them to go ahead and negotiate for a lease or a lease purchase or a purchase of some land so that they can locate that facility and then detail their cost estimate to construct it.
Senator Johnson.
The one piece, though, in response to Senator Verger's question that I don't think the legislature will hear an answer to is what about the 22 acres that they already own that never came up during the last hearing. And I would appreciate having Mr. Tindall's response on the record with respect to how thoroughly that site is going to be scrutinized before additional property is acquired in Sisters.
Chair Schrader, Senator Johnson, that site is, along with the potential co-location with the City of Sisters, if there's enough room, those are on the table, and we are looking at that and determining the costs to rezone that property. As it is a quarry site, there are some costs, and we will consider those costs and compare those with the costs of being on some other piece of land and the opportunities to co-locate with the Department of Forest
Oregon Department of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service, and all of those, we will consider all of those costs and detail out all of those benefits, and I am more than happy to, as we make this decision, come back in front of this committee or this body and report on what we did and why we did it. But that quarry site is definitely still in consideration for location of the Sisters Mountain Station.
Further discussion there? Okay. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There was something that came up several months ago that I remember asking around about. I just wanted to mention it again today so that it's on the record. As we find ourselves needing to pinch pennies and be as careful as possible, and also recognizing that public projects are often perceived by the public as simply public projects, they don't even necessarily know which budget it came out of. Was this a state thing or a county thing or a city thing? It's all taxpayer money. I remember being very interested in the possibility of a co-location where you not only share the purchase price of the property or you share the ownership, but also the efficiencies you gain from being co-located, operation efficiencies, and it ends up being more cost-effective for both or all the jurisdictions that participate. So I was very, very interested in, especially an area like that, that there was potentially some interest in saving money for everybody and ending up with something even better. We don't know that that's going to be the case. And I guess I would have hoped that by now we would have found out that we were going to be seeing a collaborative project in the interest of multiple jurisdictions. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a point of procedure. If for some reason we do not approve this proposal this time, does the department then require to come before the E-Board to get approval, or do they have to wait until the next legislative session?
They'd have to file a new request with, they wouldn't have limitation at this point, so they might be in a bit of a binding. Yeah. Slap, would you like to elaborate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, it would depend on the direction that this committee gave the department. Mm-hmm. They can come before the emergency board and request this limitation. They have a $1 limitation, which is a placeholder until information was brought to the Ways and Means. They chose to bring it in January because they were facing an April deadline to be vacated from the forest service property that was extended to the February session. If this body chooses to make them come back to an emergency board, that would be after their April deadline. They would have to locate their, which they may have to do anyway because the time has gone on, locate that staff at the their Bend facility and experience the expense of commuting further down to respond to issues in that corridor. So the answer is it depends.
That's all right. Senator Winters and Senator Bates.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, the maker of the motion, since there's been a lot of discussion and some concern, I would like to withdraw my motion and move that they come back to us with a plan. There appears to be on the panel a lot of our colleagues who want to have a little more detail. They do have the dollar placeholder there. Only, and my motion, if the agency, if it doesn't disrupt them going forward and up to where they still have the ability to do their negotiations with the member.
Mr. Chairman, would you like to respond to that?
Chair Schrader, obviously, we will do whatever you wish us to do. The part of the reason that I'm unable to answer your question today is because we don't know what the plans of the U.S. Forest Service are in terms of additional land around their area and what the cost of that land would be. Again, as I said, the most beneficial thing for us, as Representative Nathanson said, is to co-locate with Oregon Department of Forestry has expressed interest, and that's a benefit, and U.S. Forest Service has expressed interest, that's a benefit. The City of Sisters could also be a benefit in a large co-location. The problem is we don't know how much land the Forest Service is going to make available yet. They just simply haven't told us. And while they probably won't physically kick us off the property 2 months from now because they haven't given us that answer yet, when we are going to know and how that fits in with the e-board timing is an issue for us. So not approving this request today, in either case, no money will be spent because the funds will be unscheduled. Not approving this request today could give us a problem in the future in terms of just timing to get back to the legislature at the right moment when we do know, when the Forest Service tells us what they're going to do and we see what opportunities we have to co-locate.
Members of the committee, I'd also be concerned that if they don't have the expenditure limitation to move forward and make any kind of negotiate on any other land acquisitions, if the Forest Service is not an option, that they cannot bring back a detailed cost estimate to this body until that decision, so they have some knowledge of where they are going to locate those facilities. They have to have some kind of an expenditure limitation that they can be assured is available in order to negotiate in good faith.
It appears as if we need to go forward based on what our legislative fiscal staff has advised us on, but with the understanding that they come back to us with the plan.
The committee could add a report to the June e-board on progress if that would satisfy some concerns. Senator Bates, you were in the queue.
I think my question is actually answered. The question being, what are we looking at here? I think what's giving people pause is that turning the responsibility of okaying the final plan and the final expenditures over to DUSC gives the legislature a little bit of pause. I know things happen in strange and wonderful ways up here sometimes, but this seems a little more strange than normal, but maybe or wonderful, I hope. But it sounds like they need some leeway to do the negotiations, to look at their options, because they don't know what their options are yet, and I assume they need to have a place ready to go by next winter is probably the big problem, one way or the other. You know, when the snow starts to fly in October and November, they don't want to be sitting down in Redmond or Bend. They want some kind of a site up there at that elevation where they can work from. I assume that's the problem. That's the real problem, is the weather and the timing on this. So to get an answer in April or May, you've got to move on for June, July, and August. You get this thing done. That's what's going on here. And that's, I think, why you need to allow them to do this. And then have them come back and talk to us June, maybe September, too.
Yeah, I am in agreement with Senator Winters and Senator Bates. We need to approve the LFO recommendation today with the caveat that they report back to us at the first e-board meeting, which I believe is in June. I think that's the best solution.
The motion will accept that friendly amendment.
Okay, so we have a motion amended on the committee floor for the discussion.
I'm not persuaded, but I will go with the will of the committee. A report back is just telling us what has already happened. Members of this committee are hesitant to allow the e-board, which is composed of legislators, to make these decisions, and this seems that we're ceding even more legislative authority to competent and well-meaning people in the Department of Administrative Services, but I'm not going to make a big deal of it. I'm just not persuaded.
Thank you. Further discussion on the scintillating topic? Seeing none, there's a motion on the floor. Objections? We've got Co-Chair Nolan, we got Representative Hanna, Representative Edwards, and Senator Berger. I think that's it. Looks like the motion carries. Thank you, gentlemen. Ladies, very good. Very good. Mr. Jindal, look forward to seeing you in June. All right, next item on the work session agenda is Capital Construction Department of Aviation limitation increases for Aurora, Lebanon State Airports, limitation establishment for Milano Airport. Please come forward. Please start right in.
Chair Schrader, Chair Nolan, members of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. My name is Dan Clem. I'm the Director of the Department of Aviation. Before you is an amended request, budget request, for an increase to our capital construction budget. The previously, last June, you approved us to look at making necessary safety improvements on six different state-owned airports with a total budget of $8.2 million. Since that time, there has been more detailed planning, more communications, and the allowance of grants from the Federal Aviation Administration such that we need to amend, we'd like to amend the request to ask for more other funds and more federal funds to be allotted into our budget. Specifically, the major change is through an agreement with the Port of Portland and operating the Milano Airport. The Department of Aviation and the Port have entered into an agreement such that the Oregon Department of Aviation will operate the airport and make necessary improvements funded by the Port, and at such time that the airport is financially self-sustaining, that the Oregon Department of Aviation will own the airport. There will be a transfer of ownership from the Port to the Department of Aviation for $1 and subject to legislative approval. But in the interim, the Department of Aviation, through the agreement, has the responsibility of actually constructing the improvements. So the request before you for the Milano Airport is to construct 36 nested T-hangers and for an accessway taxiway to support the development of more hangars and more accessibility into the airport from the local community. Of the request that we put before you for $2.279 million, that represents $2.2 million. And other funds. For the Aurora State Airport, which is Oregon's busiest business park type airport, in a general aviation category, we're looking at receiving from the federal government a little over $3 million for the construction of this airport. Costs have increased from the earlier budget request some 37%. That's due to the cost of construction. And then also the Federal Aviation Administration allowing us to build taxiway lights for the airport, such that subject to your approval, we'd like to add airport lights to that airport so that it makes it safer for the very busy traffic that occurs at that airport now. And also the third request is for the Lebanon State Airport, which is a total overall request increase of $273,000 and $13,000 in other funds, $259,000 in federal funds. This also is a 95% federally funded project, and it's for the apron, for the taxiways, and for lights to be installed at the Lebanon State Airport, making this a much safer, small general aviation airport. With that, we've asked for a total increase of $3.7 million, $2.2 million coming from the Port of Portland, and approximately $1.4 million coming from federal funds, for a total of $3.7 million. Subject to your questions, that's my brief on our capital construction request.
Thank you. Mayor Johnson.
Mr. Chair, out of an abundance of caution, I would like the record to reflect that I've been involved in the aviation industry for 30-plus years, and I formerly held Mr. Clem's position. Also, my husband is the fixed-based operator at Scappoose. Improvements in the aviation system could conceivably benefit the economic activity at Scappoose.
Further discussion. I have a question about the improvements of interest support of Portland with regard to the Milano Airport. It's a fairly small airport. I understand that there was a protracted, interesting discussion about that some 20 years ago. The proximity of the Roar Airport compared to the Molino Airport is arguably pointing to that airport being more a Port of Portland type of interest than Molino. Any discussion in your department about that?
Senator Schrader, the discussion occurred before my arrival at the Department of Aviation, but I will tell you that today, as I'm aware, there is no interest in the Port of Portland for the Aurora State Airport. The Aurora State Airport is a business park airport and a small general aviation airport, but as it's become very, very busy, a lot of the planes that were using Aurora State Airport are looking for a general aviation airport that is close but not so busy. In the interest of protecting and enhancing general aviation in Oregon's airports, the assumption and the operation of the Molino Airport really serves a lot of those flying public that Aurora may not suit their needs, and yet it's close enough to the urban areas and rural areas to meet their needs. Port of Portland is not interested in, as I'm aware, of operating general aviation airports at this time.
Okay. Another motion?
Yes.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I move that the, and LFO, please feel free to correct me if my numbers are wrong. I move that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means approve a motion to amend Senate Bill 555 to reflect an increase in the other funds expenditure limitation of $65,973, an increase in the federal funds expenditure limitation of $1,178,928 for the Oregon State Airport, an increase in other funds expenditure limitation of $13,658, and the federal funds expenditure limitation of $259,511 on State Airport, and establish another fund expenditure limitation of $2,200,000 for Molino Airport.
Okay. Well done.
Yeah.
And do you have anything to add?
Mm-hmm.
No. Anything that's superfluous? So I apologize.
Okay.
If you wrote the suggestion, we'd really be in trouble.
Okay.
Further discussion? Objections? Seeing none? So ordered. Good job. All right, let's go to work session, Senate Bill 5556, Budget Reconciliation, Department of Transport, Aviation again. Limitation increase for the operations for the balance of the 07-09 biennium. I'm going to ask staff to preface why this is before us today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Aviation received a 12-month expenditure limitation during the legislative session. At that time, the agency had discovered some inaccuracies in their accounting records, and they didn't have a good number to begin a provide an estimate of what their actual beginning balance amounts were going to be. And as a result, the legislature gave them a one-year budget with the direction to come back to the legislature during the special session to request the second year of their budget. Since that time, the department has been working closely with the Department of Administrative Services to reconcile those accounts. They're not quite finished, but they are finished enough that they can project now what their beginning cash balance is for this current biennium and what the revenues will be for the remainder of the biennium. And they are now requesting the second year of their budget.
Very good. Let's start with... Well, actually, the department should probably speak first, if that's all right. Mr. Clem.
Chair Schrader, Chair Nolan, members of the Joint Ways and Means. My name is Dan Clem. I'm the Director of Oregon Department of Aviation. You should have in front of you a briefing packet, and what I'll do is briefly go through the first six slides and then spend a couple of minutes talking about what we're doing to right the agency financially. If you could, please turn to the third slide. The current budget that you'd approved in June of 07 is reflected there. It shows a one-year authorization for our operations of statewide services and the capital construction funds. The fourth slide shows the budget note direction, which Ms. Jordan has summarized for you, but it directed us to come back with a reconciliation of state and federal transactions and balances. I want to point out that that goes back 6 to 7 years of postings of making sure that the state transactions, state monies were posted to the proper accounts, and the federal monies were posted to the proper accounts. We have completed the reconciliation. What is not complete yet is the repostings of thousands of transactions. We know that the cash balances are essentially correct, but at this point in time, it's going to take us probably another 6 to 8 weeks to get every dollar back into the correct transactional account. That's a little difficult when you're talking about three biennia because accounts change and titles change, but we hired extra help, got a lot of help out of Brass, and we anticipate within the next 6 to 8 weeks we'll have at least all of the correct accounts reposted. In that budget note direction, we did also split out separate funds for pavement maintenance program for the capital construction matching fund, and I want to report to you that you had also asked to take a look at aircraft registration revenues. Our ability to collect fees for pilot registrations pays for the state search and rescue program, and we found some improvements needed to be made there. We had asked for a pop for two maintenance positions, and I'll explain in a minute what we're doing to try to correct that. The next slide is titled Actions Taken. We've delayed a number of maintenance projects of note. The windsock at the airport is red, and it looks like a cone, and it flies from a pole, and it's called a windsock. And as you're coming into the airport, you're landing and taking off. It gives you an idea of the crosswinds and what the winds are at the airport. We used to buy those and replace those when they became tattered or they weren't red anymore. Well, we turn them inside out, we spray paint them, and we put them right back up. Again, a small, silly example of what we're doing to save money, but I got to tell you, our maintenance guys have gotten to be very, very savvy about how to repair lights, windsocks, asphalt, aprons, hangar doors, you name it. We've outsourced the engineering work such that we only pay for the technical expertise that we need when we need it. We've developed partnerships through what we call the Aero Program. At this time, we have 19 volunteers on different airports who help provide the eyes and ears on the state's 28 owned or operated airports. And they've also chipped in with some maintenance help. We have agreements with a couple of experimental aircraft associations to conduct some of the mowing, and some of that's trade for some land lease. But in fact, where it's cost-effective to do so, we've tried to involve others in helping us maintain the airports. We completed the Oregon Aviation Plan, which was an exhaustive look at the present and the future for Oregon's airports, and we've been working closely with DAS on the grant reconciliation. If I could get you to turn to the next slide that shows cash management. One of the reasons
you
for the
probably public, summarize that.
I'd love to.
All right, Mr. Chair. Unless the members want more detail. Okay. Summary sounds good, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the operations budget request is the slide, at the seventh slide in your packet, and I'll summarize there. Cash balance of estimated of 1 July of 2007 was $463,000. When we passed the budget in June of 2007, we were concerned about how much money was actually the state's and how much was federal money. We've sorted that out, and our balance was $463,000. The budget request I have in front of you shows the revenues and expenses that I'm planning on executing so that we end up with a minimum of a cash balance of $514,000, which represents about a 90-day operational reserve. You would like to see us with a six-month operational reserve. We've increased rates. We've increased collections on fees. We've done everything that we can to increase revenue. But, in fact, my best guess, 12 months, 16 months, worst case, it will end up in this position of $514,000. With that, I've asked for the continuance of an LD position to which LFO has recommended that, and for the increase in the other funds of $2.5 million. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Clem inherited a financial mess when he showed up at aviation. He has done a nearly miraculous job of truing up the department's budget, and I would like to use this forum to recognize his leadership. Also, because this is a different bill and out of an abundance of caution, I would like it on the record that I've been involved with the aviation industry for 30-plus years, formerly holding Mr. Clem's job. My husband is the fixed-base operator at Scappoose. Improvements in the aviation system could conceivably economically benefit activity at Scappoose.
Thank you very much, Senator. Further discussion?
Would you like a motion again?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Ready?
Well, we don't have MFOs.
Well, I'm going to use the caution. I said not to.
But you're from the MFO, so then you can make the motion.
Telephone, need to say something?
I do.
And first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Blake Johnson, DAS Budget Management. We support the agency's request and recommend approval.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LFO is concerned that the ending balance will be inadequate if the revenues are not received as they projected. But in spite of our reservations, the agency has done an excellent job of capturing the revenues that they and increasing those revenues over this last biennium, and they are moving ahead with an interagency agreement with the Port of Portland as a, I'm going to call it a demonstration project, hopefully something that they can build off of for their other general aviation facilities to increase the revenues at those facilities or leases with their aviation facilities. And I am recommending the 12 months of expenditure limitation and the limited duration position with the understanding that the director is going to monitor those revenues and expenditures very closely, and if there are if the revenues are not materializing as they anticipated, that they will take actions to reduce their expenditures before they come back to the legislature during the next session. But I am recognizing that they need the ability to create more, create that revenue in order to become a sustainable agency.
Translations, you may see them again.
Mr. Co-Chair, I would move the LFO recommendation.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Further discussion? Yes, Senator Witzel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Panelman, the operations budget request year two shows 100% increase in administrative charges to other programs.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Operations budget request year two on that slide.
Mm-hmm.
It shows an administrative charges to other programs increase of 100%. Could you explain that a little bit, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witz, that the department's operations program was bearing all the costs associated with the capital construction and the pavement maintenance program. The idea here is to ask those programs who have separate revenue sources from operations budget to assume some of that cost. And so in sorting out the accounts, the revenues, and the expenses, it made sense that a reasonable share of FTE cost would be assigned to capital construction and pavement maintenance program.
Good response, thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to briefly echo Senator Johnson's comments. I want to commend Mr. Clem for his candidness and management expertise in working through the budget issues with this department. As Senator Johnson indicated, he inherited a financial train wreck and has done an excellent job of managing through those issues. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Wish you the best, sounds like here. Further discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Thank you.
All right. Next item, Senate Bill 5556 still, is the Office of Private Health Partnerships, the budget status. Rocky and others. Welcome, Mr. King.
Co-chair, I should say. Madam Co-chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Office of Private Health Partnerships. We administer what is called the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. We refer to it as FIAP. I'm here today really to provide you a report to apprise you of the consequences of a federal policy change and its impact on the FIAP program and the actions that we are proposing to take over the next few months. And just to give you a little background, and there is a report that you've been provided that goes into a lot more depth, but in late October of this year, we were notified by the federal government that effective November 1st, and we were given about 10 days' notice, that we would no longer be able to use Title 21 federal dollars provide coverage for adults in the FIOP program, again effective November 1st. Because our waiver application had been back with the federal government, CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, for almost a year, notifying us in the last week prior to our waiver becoming effective was somewhat of a surprise to us. At the very least, we thought if they changed their policy, that would at least provide a phase-in or transition period for us to be able to find other sources of funds for those that we'd be losing by not being able to use that match rate. Throughout November and early December, we negotiated with federal government, including engaging our congressional delegation in the governor's office to try to see if that we could get them to either change their position or at least provide us with a period of transition. We were not successful in that endeavor. In the background, Congress continued to work on an authorization of the state's Children Health Insurance Program, and we were hoping, working with our congressional delegation, that we could get maybe a fix in the federal legislation. We were not successful there. And additionally, Congress was looking at the economic stimulus package, which they recently passed, and there was some work on the part of a variety of states' congressional delegations to try to change the match rate within that economic stimulus package to help address some of the shortfalls that many of us were facing because of this federal policy change. Again, we were not successful in getting that. The impact of this federal policy change is a reduction in our federal match rate of about 12%. And that's taking from a Title 21 rate of 72.96 down to a Title 19 rate of 61.32. Now, what this equates to is a projected shortfall of about $5.6 million of general fund. Now, we're using some of our beginning balance and trying to get this as low as possible, but that, and it brings it down to about a shortfall of about $5 million. What do we do? Well, we first thing we did is sit back and say, let's develop some guidelines as we develop some of the options to address this shortfall. One is we wanted to make sure we harm the fewest people possible in the FIOP program, and to ensure that hopefully those that we did kind of impact, that they would have some option for coverage someplace else. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that we didn't touch really the group insurance, those folks involved with group insurance through their employers, because that would create a lot of problems for both the employer and for those individuals. And finally, we wanted to make sure we crafted options that didn't impact children, that we would not get into a position of disenrolling any child because of this federal action. Three options that we looked at. Let me, quick summary. First of all, take everybody basically above 100% of the federal poverty level that's enrolled in FIOP. That's about 3,900 folks. Again, not counting children, not counting group, and disenroll them from the program. Option number one. Option number two was to come and request $5 million to pick up this shortfall. We did not see that as a strong option given the economic downturn that we're seeing in our economy and stagnation. There's not a lot of dollars out there right now, and we're aware of that. The third option was to really take advantage of standard program opening up in VHS and the Medicaid program, and to take those people below 85% of the federal poverty level and to move them over to the Medicaid standard program. Now, you really don't move them. What you do is give them an option and basically say, we're going to have to disenroll you from this program, but there is optional alternative coverage available to you through the Department of Human Services standard program when it opens. And that would be about 3,900 people, and that would be effective May 1st. Working with the governor's office and the stakeholders, we've decided to put forth recommendation number three, which would require the Department of Human Services and in our agency to pursue federal approval to move all of FIOP adults under 85% of the federal poverty level, and that's about $737 a month for one person, just to put it in perspective. Those enrolled in the individual market to the OHP standard program effective May 1st, 2008. which would result in a caseload reduction of about 3,835 individuals in FEOP, and would result in a savings of approximately $5 million in general fund, and would cover the shortfall and allow us then to live within the legislatively adopted budget. We'll work with the stakeholders and DHS to find the most efficient and least disruptive process for accomplishing this transfer of clients. Now, while we believe that this option stays within the principles that we've outlined, I don't want to minimize the impact it has on people. We make financial decisions all the time and shift things, but this does have an impact on those people that are enrolled, their families in FEOP, about 2,000 of which are enrolled in the state's high-risk pool and have chronic health care conditions. But the fact of the matter is there's no money available. We tried to craft the best option so that people at least, they may not get the same coverage, may not even get the same docs, but at least they're going to have some access through a fairly good program, the standard program, to receiving their health care, meeting their health care needs. And while imperfect, it's much better than having no alternative for coverage at all. Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we're really here today just to ask for your understanding of the actions we're going to take and acceptance of the report. We may have to come back at some future point and look at some limitation increase for using the beginning balance, but we're not prepared to do that at this point. And again, I should stress, this is dependent upon the federal government approving what our plan is at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good summary.
Can I ask a question?
Senator Winters, please.
Just a brief question. What kind of signals are you receiving from the feds in your conversation with them as to the likelihood of them approving it, number one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, right now we have not entered into those discussions. We've got basically the outline of the process there. Mr. Edge, from who's the administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, is here and probably can talk about it a little bit more, but I think they've been notified at one point that we perhaps will be coming to them with this request, but we have not received any indication from them at this point whether they would approve it.
Father, as the senator who negotiated the provider tax in 2003, what are some of the discussions with the stakeholders and what is their reaction to your proposal?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, they've had discussions with both the managed care plans as well as the hospitals. The hospitals have not had an opportunity to really talk to all of the members of their association, so they have not taken any position, either pro or con, against this particular proposal. We do have the support of the managed care plans at this stage, so we're not facing any big opposition. These are folks that the docs are going to see, whether they're insured or uninsured, and I think everybody's trying to figure out how we can mix and match the funding sources to make sure that these folks have access to coverage. So as far as I know, the managed care plans are in support of this. The hospitals are neither against nor for, but have not taken an official position.
There was some indication that possibly at some point federally that they would begin to put a kibosh or some barriers in the way, if you will, for the kind of leveraging that we have done with respect to the provider tax. Is that still in movement? Have they eased up? What do we look for? Because, you know, as we talk about creating financing, and that's really was what we did in 2003 and 2005 and when we could, you know, we've been waiting on those days when the federal government would say that, you know, oops, you states don't like your methodology.
Ms. Chair, Senator Winters, I'd really feel more comfortable if Mr. Edge came up and responded to that, because they've been involved, I think, more in discussions with him about the provider tax.
Thank you,
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Edge. I'm the administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. Mr. King has given a good summary of the situation that we're in. In specific answer to Senator Winter's question, the provider taxes, as currently structured, according to federal regulation and state law, will go away in October of 2009. So that is the kibosh that you were speaking of, and we will no longer have those taxes available after October of 2009.
Follow up. Mr. Co-Chair, I think that's important for us to note, because come 2009, we're going to have to deal as a state with this particular issue. We managed from 03 to date to have been able to utilize the provider tax assessment and to use those dollars to leverage federal dollars. But come 2009, we'll be looking at that not being available. And I ask that question because sometimes we're not looking ahead as to what will be coming down the track. It's the same issue that we had several years ago when we didn't pass the measure that would have kept 120,000 covered under the Oregon Health Plan. So I wanted to put that in the record, Mr. Co-Chair.
We've got Senator Bates, then Senator Verger, then Vice Chair Nathanson is going to conduct the hearing for a short period of time. Well, Chairman and I step out just for a moment. We look forward to being back here.
It'll probably go a lot faster.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry the co-chair has had to leave. It's educational for them. They would need to hear this. And I'll talk to them personally about it later. As the father of the provider tax, not the negotiator, this has been a good thing for us the last 6 years, but it is changing. Mr. Edge, correct me if I'm wrong, the part of the tax we're talking about losing here is the managed care part, because it's not a broad-based tax. It's taxed only on Medicaid programs, but not the provider tax necessarily for the hospitals. And if we were to make that tax a broader base, we'd probably still be within the limits of federal law at this time. Is that correct or incorrect?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, you're correct in that the federal regulation is going to make the managed care provider tax go away in October of 2009 because it is not a broad-based tax. If we were to change and make it a broad-based tax, that would be a different situation. The other thing I might point out is in state statute, both the hospital tax and the provider tax are linked and go away at the same time.
Thank you, follow-up. I appreciate that clarification. I would point out that welcome to the Byzantine world of Medicaid, which is so Byzantine most of us can't follow or understand it, those of us who live with it every day. And this points to me the ridiculous situation we're in health care in the state. We're having a lottery to decide if you get health care or not. And we're losing an important program. It's a FIAP program. I have a couple of questions about the FIAP program that I think need to be brought out. The FIAP program has been, as I understand it, based on a shared responsibility financially between individuals, employers, federal government, and state government. One of the things that has been difficult with that is many employers and their insurance brokers don't trust the system entirely because they're worried that they'll get started on the program, they'll fund the program, and the state will then pull the money out of it or put those patients somewhere else. Is that correct, Mr. King?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Bates, yes, it is.
And we are continuing the process of now pulling the rug out of some of those employers. Luckily, this time, they're not going to be stuck with the bill because you're talking about moving into OHP standard, thus decreasing the number of probably 10,000 positions that the 60,000 people are vying for right now. My question to Mr. King is, has there been a discussion about using some of the OHP standard money, the money that comes from the provider tax, to backfill that 12% so we can maintain the FIAP program the way it is, knowing that the providers
that take care of those patients, including the hospitals, the ones that are paying the tax, now get reimbursed at a commercial rate, which is about twice as high as the Medicaid rate. Have you had that conversation in your department or with the hospitals yet?
Mr. Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I have not been part of those discussions, but they have taken place. Again, I think the hospitals at this stage have not taken a position. The managed care plans, from my understanding, preferred to have to stay with the standard and have the people go from FEOP over to standard. I think that that is, again, one of the viable options that we've tried to talk with them about.
Yes. Obviously, for the managed care plans, there's a gain to having it go this way. They're going to have the patients one way or the other, unless they stay in the FEOP program, in which case they would not have them in their managed care plan. So they have a vested interest in seeing it go the way you're suggesting it. I'm asking, have you looked at it from the point of view of, can you backfill that with OHP standard monies, which are basically the provider tax? And what is the net result of the state? Do we get more leverage through the FEOP plan? Do we get more leverage going OHP standard with the 60-40 match from the federal government?
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, in terms of cost, it is generally, I think, a little less expensive to have the people served in the FEOP program, primarily because of the co-pays and deductibles that those and the portion of the premium that those folks pay. Plus, we have many people in the high-risk pool that are somewhat subsidized by the assessment of insurers throughout the state. In terms of the viability or legality of using the provider tax, I'm going to defer that to Jim, who can speak to that, I believe.
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, we have looked at that option. It would be possible, we feel, to move that money rather than to give those clients the option of moving to the standard program. It's a less desirable option for the payers of the taxes, it seems like, at this time. So the letter that Mr. King has written proposes the option of allowing those individuals to move to the standard program.
Follow up the last question.
Last one, yeah. Thank you.
First of all, I want to apologize for members of this committee. It takes so much time. This is very complex, but the amount of money is really pretty significant when you get down to it. Mr. Edge and Mr. King, I would ask you to have that conversation with those providers before you make that assessment. They're going to look at rates dropping by 50% in one group with their provider tax compared to what they're dealing with now. I think you better look at that real carefully before you tell us what you think the hospitals are thinking about right now. So I'd ask you to go back and have that conversation and bring it back to us as a fourth possible option.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we'll do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Senator Berger.
Thank you very much. I just mainly, Madam Chair, want to make a statement, and I'm really preaching to the choir here, and I know most of you will agree with what I'm going to say, but I need to say it for myself. And that is that all of these programs and this funding is all about our clients. These are things about people. And so when we talk about partnerships with the federal government, you obviously have no requirement at all that you have any advance notice. You have no requirement that a program that's put in is going to be sustainable or will last. I can't think of anything in the world making me feel more insecure and worrisome than to be chronically ill, requiring this kind of service and help, and at the same time living within a certain degree of poverty. And so I think if we can continue to remain focused on clients as well as our programs and to be more motivated, I think we can come up with best answers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? At this time, I'd like to hear from budget management first, please.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Eric Moore, Budget Management. We would recommend acknowledging receipt of report.
Thank you. Legislative Fiscal Office.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. We likewise recommend acknowledging receipt of this report. And I would note for the record that the agency can come back in June with a report one way or the other and a response to Senator Bates' questions.
Would someone like to make that motion?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Are there objections? Okay. Thank you. We will move to the next item, which is Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. There, it looks like there are three kinds of items on this portion of the agenda. The first part listed on our agenda is infrastructure inventory activities. Are you prepared to speak to that one first?
Madam Vice Chair, I would respectfully request that we could talk about the second item, which is the regional investment boards first, then go to the needs and issues or the infrastructure discussion, then conclude with the remaining of the budget notes.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, committee members. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Economic Community Development Department for the state. We are here to present to you a series of budget notes that were part of our 2007 budget bill, Senate Bill 5508, that were directed primarily to my commission for specific action in this report. I'm pleased to be with you today to let you know that we've accomplished all the work that we've been asked to have ready for the February session that we're in today, and we're on track to finish our rest of our work for the some remaining budget notes that will take place for responses and action in 2009 legislative session. We have, as I mentioned, as the Vice Chair was asking, we've broken this into three presentations. First one, we'll be talking about the regional investment boards. We heard some of the testimony from the public testimony component regarding regional investment boards. The second element will be on infrastructure, a budget note that required us to work with the regional investment boards to do an assessment of what is the needs of infrastructure around the state of Oregon. And then third, it's the kind of the collection of all the other budget notes that were germane to the agency related to performance measures and outcomes and things of that nature. You should have had delivered to your offices through a process through the mailing system. I know that might be a little more difficult because you're not in your normal offices. Three different documents. The first one is the Regional Investment Board. It's a light blue binder. I don't know how many of you have it with you, but we brought extra copies. If you don't have it, raise your hand. The second report is the infrastructure report, which is a green binder, and we brought ones for that also for you. And finally, the remaining of our budget notes are found in a yellow binder. So we will be going through those three presentations with you today, time permitted. I'm proud to have one of our Economic Development Commission members with us. Commissioner Hyde actually is a commissioner by trade for two reasons. One, he's our commissioner on the Economic Development Board for the last 4 years. He just was recently reappointed for four more years by incentive confirmation here just recently. He also is a county commissioner for us in the state of Oregon. So he represents a very small and important part of our relationship with our county partners, and has actual personal knowledge of our regional investment boards work in his region. So, I'm sure if you don't mind, I'd like to present Mr. Hyde for his presentation.
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm here today as for the record, Tony Hyde. I'm here today representing the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. The commission appreciates the opportunity before the committee to discuss the interim work that has been accomplished in response to the Legislative Assembly's budget notes. At your direction, in mid-07, the commission evaluated various aspects of the regional investment program. The commission looked at each of the legislative directives and created a process to inform the decision-making. The commission members were actively involved in gathering the information, and the outcomes were an established plan to allocate the 07 funding for the RIBs, determine the capability of each board to carry out certain tasks, develop administrative standards for the boards, determine the role of the boards as part of the OECD's strategic plan, approve accountability measures, and develop recommendations for future roles of the boards. I'm not going to ask you to dig into this today, but I'm again reiterate that this was a compilation of an awful lot of work on the part of the department and economic development partners around the state of Oregon. So I invite you to peruse this at your convenience. On behalf of the Commission, I'd like to add that this undertaking has proven to be a valuable experience, and we appreciate the legislature providing impetus for us to visit the four corners of the state, learn about and understand the value of the regional investment program, and evaluate options to improve our delivery of economic development services in Oregon. Furthermore, this opportunity has allowed the Commission, working in concert with Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and the state's economic development partners, to further assess the specific program areas and recommend items for improvement as we move forward to the 09 session. In the limited time today, I'd like to call your particular attention to the Commission's summary of conclusions concerning the roles and responsibilities of the regional investment boards. Those findings are on page 1 through 6 of the report. To paraphrase the Commission's findings, the regional board's strategies are current and were approved by the Commission in less than 2 months ago. The regional investment board strategies are aligned with the economic development goals outlined in statute and demonstrate the valuable role the boards have had in the state's comprehensive economic development efforts. The boards play an important role in the delivery of economic development and community development services across the state, particularly in rural areas. And finally, regional perspectives are valuable because the economic health and growth of areas within the region are interdependent, and communities should not be viewed in isolation. While we recognize the value of the regional investment boards in delivering the state's economic development services, the Commission believes some adjustments will allow the program to be even more effective. In the past, boards have been required to tie their allocation of state funds directly to the metric of job creation. This has caused the boards to be unable to address other economic development needs, such as antiquated sewers and safe drinking water systems. The board should be able to use funds for the projects regardless of a direct link to job creation, and this is a big step for us. However, the Commission, with the help of the Department, needs to develop criteria to determine project funding and ensure future accountability. To ensure appropriate representation, board structures may need to be modified. There's a lack of clarity in defining the major goals, and changes in direction have created a climate of uncertainty and disagreement over the board's roles. While the Commission and the Department would like to provide better direction and accountability, changes cannot be proposed without additional discussions with interested parties. Therefore, the Commission recommends that we work with OECD, the Governor's Office, the Legislature, the boards, and others to develop recommendations for the 09 session. And that concludes my testimony, and on behalf of the Commission, I'd like to offer my gratitude again for the Assembly's interest in the Regional Investment Program. And I also want to thank again the Herculean amount of effort that went on to provide this document on the part of all of the partners in the state of Oregon.
Madam Vice Chair, with some closing comments, the document that Commissioner High is working on again is the light blue one. I just wanted to highlight, you can look on the table of contents, and much of the summary of the Commission is in the beginning part, but I think it's appropriate to, important to note the appendices that were included there. Those are the A through Ks that are there. We wanted to make sure that the Legislative Assembly realized the amount of commitment the Commission made in this effort, along with our regional partners. If you notice, the very first entry for minutes from the July 27th meeting, so only but 3 weeks after you adjourned this assembly, the Commission took this this chart on these budget notes and really dove into the discussion at hand. What you have is basically a timeline of all the activities, all the discussions that they had with the Regional Investment Board partners, the debates and the discussions during their Commission meetings to bring you this finality of this final document to you today. So, again, much credit goes to my Commission for rolling their sleeves up to get engaged in this in a very short period of time. One could arguably say you have a report that would have normally might have taken the normal time of a biennium to complete for you.
you what you actually have in front of you in 6 months.
Thank you, Mr. Lupine. Before we move to the next part, I'd like to ask if there are questions or comments on this section of the testimony. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Lupine. Given that I, along with Representative Edwards, sit as ex officio to the commission, we have had the opportunity to see up closely how hard Ms. Hannes and your agency has worked, as well as all of the regional boards. How much money do you think has been spent to bring these reports to this committee at this juncture?
Madam Vice Chair, Senator Johnson, other committee members, we've not really run a tally on that, but I would suggest to you that we probably have the better part of at least 3 to 5 people working almost for the last 6 months within the agency, trying to coordinate and orchestrate this. Enormous amount of time by other staff getting the commission dialed in and prepared for the discussion, so they were apprised of the discussion activities. And then that's not to mention the dozens, if not hundreds, of hours that the regional investment boards all invested in this to meet, to have these discussions, to formulate their reports back to us. And so the process, I think, has been, I would say, it's probably pushed us over $500,000 to $750,000 when it was all said and done.
Yes.
My point in asking, and I want to be clear about this, my point in asking was not to levy a criticism at the agency. My point in asking was to put particular emphasis on how nimbly the agency responded and how seriously they took the budget notes and how seriously the regional investment boards took their assignment. My point being that I think that many of them felt that absent this kind of very serious heavy lifting, they wouldn't be seriously considered for refunding. And so that's the reason that I made the inquiry, that these reports do not come to you with an absence of effort or an absence of money, and I think they came with the inherent belief that the legislature would look very seriously at the work of the regional investment boards and the needs across our aging infrastructure with an eye towards responding favorably to requests for continuing investment in the work of the boards. And so I just wanted to get on the record, this was not an inexpensive undertaking.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Mr. Hyde, you testified, I believe, that the commission has decided that perhaps jobs and job creation and retention should not be the end-all, so to speak. What are key performance measures 1, 2, and 3 that permeate all the way through all these documents are basically number of jobs created, number of jobs retained, and the amount of estimated state personal income tax generated by investment. So is it the commission's position that some of those key performance measures should be changed, or is there a way we can comport with your decision with those key performance measures?
Madam Chair, Senator, I will speak for the commission in this and understand, I'm speaking for myself, trying to understand where the commission was on this, but clearly I think that we believe that although job creation is a performance measure, and it's clearly the performance measure we're required to use right now, we feel that that's only one component. As I said earlier, I can't remember who I was talking to, but we all too often try to direct arteries to key organs instead of understanding the circulatory system.
Additional questions or comments? Legislative Fiscal Office, do you have some additional information for us?
An issue where LFO is making a specific recommendation in addition to acknowledging receipt of the report. The budget note, there was $2 million allocated to the Economic Development Department for costs associated with maintaining the boards through the remainder of the biennium. There was a specific direction that the board cease providing grant and loans out of the funds that were allocated in the 07-09 biennium. And if the legislature intends the boards to continue operating at reduced levels for the remainder of the biennium, Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the boards be authorized to use the balance remaining and any administrative savings or other resources that they may identify to resume their grant and loan programs.
Thank you. Ms. Lamont, are we going to go through motions to accept reports one at a time on this part of the agenda?
Madam Chair, that is your preference. We could very easily do all three at once. I'm going to wait. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I was going to offer motions, but if you're inclined to wait, I'm perfectly happy to.
If I see someone ready, I just assume take care of business and check it off the list.
Okay. In that case, I would, I don't have it right in front of me, but I would move the LFO recommendation to receive the report and to authorize the regional boards to continue. I don't have the language in front of me. Robin, help me.
I will read it. To resume the grant and loan program using the balance remaining out of the $2 million and any administrative savings or other resources available.
That was my motion.
That was a really good one. Are there objections? No objections to note. Okay. Let's move to the second part, report on infrastructure inventory activities.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, committee members. Another important report that's in front of you, which in the green spiral binder, was a very comprehensive report. There was a charge in our budget note that was made to my commission in concert and partnership with our regional investment boards around the state. Those 13 regional investment boards took on the task of identifying the infrastructure needs of their region. Generally, those were around infrastructure such as sewer and water, but also crossed over into some transportation-related issues, also public buildings, the courts, a variety of topics of which Ms. Hannes will be talking about here shortly in her presentation.
Mr. Rebron?
Yes.
Excuse me, we have a procedural issue to take care of. The committee is going to stand at ease for a few minutes. I hope no more than 3 minutes. Resuming the work session on OECD, and Mr. Repine is resuming with his comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Again, we'll be talking with the on a document that we've handed out to you, this green document. This is the entire report relative to needs and issues or infrastructure requests that was part of the budget note from last session. A very comprehensive, time-consuming activity by all 13 of the regions to compilate the information that you have in that document. With me, Ann Hannes, who is the manager of our Community Development Division, will be making that presentation. Now, as all things go with technology, we've had this laptop sitting up here since we started, but for some reason now the laptop's not working. So we, oh, it might be coming up. Okay. We thought maybe we were going to have to resume to paper. Not that we don't already have the paper. We're hoping.
I'm considering asking someone to bar the doors, but you're going to have to work fast here.
I will work fast.
We're going to we're going to need to move through this pretty quickly because of how much is left on the agenda and because of potentially losing members to other meetings.
For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, and I'm the manager for the Community Development Division. This infrastructure inventory is a result of budget notes that asked us to put together an inventory of the state of the needs and issues. Let's see if I can get this to come up as I'm talking. The budget notes ask for developing priority criteria by the commission, preparing a consolidated statewide infrastructure priority list, and developing an infrastructure funding request. Okay. Okay, now it's up. It also asks that the regional investment boards be involved by developing that needs initiative list and constructing the infrastructure needs list, and then ways and means legislators ask that a top 10 list for each region be developed. They identify top barriers to economic development. That is in your book in Appendix C, but I just want to draw your attention that the major barriers to economic development were identified as transportation, infrastructure, and industrial land availability and workforce. The importance of this infrastructure inventory is one that it gives you a snapshot in time of the infrastructure needs across Oregon. It assists in funding decisions. We hope that it will provide a useful list for you to be able to look at what's in your area. We did deliver a packet to you earlier this week, and if you look in that packet, there's a report that was generated for your district or counties that lists the different infrastructure projects that were inputted by communities. It also indicates where additional financing is needed. One thing, no matter how you kind of slice and dice this, the needs far exceed the existing resources that we have.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I could interrupt, Aunt, just for a moment. In this book that you've provided us, you have, towards the back, a list of the infrastructure inventory, water, sewer, and stormwater projects by primary reason. And again, it's listed alphabetically. Did you ever, through this process, go through and break down the condition of our infrastructure by when it fails? And you have listed here, and I'm just picking one out, Adair Village, and it appears that their raw water pump station building needs to be completed by 2009 to repair a 65-year-old building, and the reason why is it's antiquated. But there are lots of them that expire at different dates, and I'm trying to get that snapshot for this committee so that they realize how many, if you divided them into three categories, good, fair, and failing. I'm going to submit, having not seen this list, that the good is about this big, the fair is about this big, and failing is about that big. And I'm trying to figure out, did you ever do a cut that way?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Johnson, what we were able to do was to be able to say, okay, with those projects that needed to be done within the next 2 to 3 years that had antiquated systems and that had state or federal regulatory issues were ones that we could highlight. We have a list. I have a table a little bit later in my presentation that shows how much that amounts to. Eventually, what we hope to be able to do is to be able to run different reports with different filtering criteria to get a little bit better at what you have. It's not real easy to be able to say exactly where each system is, but we can identify which ones are having regulatory problems, which ones have antiquated systems, and which ones need to have it right away.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, and before the follow-up, I was trying to take care of other logistics. Could you tell me what page to turn to?
Well,
I'm trying to follow that.
Unfortunately, I don't know if they're paginated. It's about two-thirds of the way in the green book, and it's headed infrastructure inventory, sewer, water, and storm water projects.
As Madam Chair, it's after towards the appendix of Appendix J.
It's Appendix J, yes.
Is there a page number at the bottom there in the little tiny title?
Well, it'll start out as one.
I think up through page 37, and then it starts over again. And
after page 4 of Appendix J, then you'll see a listing of water, sewer, and stormwater projects by primary reason.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. My other question, Madam Vice Chair, is we all, I think, have a tendency to turn to our own area, which is the area that we know the best, and I succumbed to that temptation. So I looked at Northwest Oregon Economic Alliance, and I saw the list of 10. And my curiosity is that as communities develop this list of 10, was this list blessed by anybody? Was there a public forum in which, say, county commissioners received the information and memorialized it as being a fair representation?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Johnson, if you look behind Appendix G, there is a listing of each of the process used to select the top 10 projects for each of the region. They did it in various different ways, but generally, I'd say for all of them, they did have a public process, and they ran it through the members of their board and the community.
My point, Madam Chair, is that that has been one of the criticisms leveled against this program, and I wanted to get clearly on the record that there was a public process, that this wasn't just decided in a vacuum someplace, and that elected folks participated in the development of this list. This wasn't some voodoo compilation, that there was a public process that caused those 10 numbers to be, those 10 projects to be in front of us.
There was significant outreach on this by not only the agency, but the regional boards, Association of Oregon Counties, and League of Oregon Cities, special districts and ports. So there were many, many people on.
Thank you. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you.
Sure, Nathanson, I might add just in tab E, you can actually get a list of those entities and each of the reasons why it was invited to 10. So these are ones that didn't participate, but they were aware the event was going on. So we, in some areas, we probably touched every human being that resides in some of these counties.
Thank you. Ms. Hannes, would you like to resume your testimony?
Thank you. In looking at the scope of the infrastructure inventory, I think it's important to understand that we were trying to get at projects that were important for economic development. This was a voluntary participation on the part of the community, so not every community chose to participate, but as Director Repine pointed out, we have listed on those on there which communities decided that they did not participate. Some of the large cities chose not to participate because they had their own mechanisms for getting financing for projects. But they were, like the city of Portland sent us a letter in support of what we were doing. For those cities greater than 40,000, we asked them to enter only projects where they thought that they might need our funding. I want to emphasize that what you're seeing in terms of the results is raw data. It's preliminary. We still need to do further analysis. This was a project that we got done in about 6 months. It was an amazing effort to do. We also tried to not duplicate some lists like what ODOT has, so we asked communities not to include road streets, highways that were federally or state-owned. But we did include local transportation projects and those necessary for industrial commercial sites, rail, and port projects. The priority criteria was approved by our commission. For those projects that ranked high, they were ones that were necessary for economic development in the next 3 years. There are also ones where you had an example might be a water system out of compliance, a rail line for business expansion. Medium projects were ones necessary in 4 to 6 years, a little further out, and community facilities and low all other projects. One of the things that I think was really outstanding what was done here, and I want to recognize some OACD staff like Jackie Yoder and Helen Wang. They put together a web-based system that was decision-based, so that as people answered any of their projects, answered a series of questions, it then rated it according to high, medium, and low projects. These are examples of all the different types of projects that are in the inventory. I'm not going to go through them, but I think as you look through your list for your districts or counties, it'll give you a flavor for the immensity of the type of projects that are there. In terms of the entire inventory, this is all high, medium, and low projects. More than 3,200 projects were entered, amounting to a $13 billion cost, where they would need about $10 billion in financing. The primary reasons for the projects, and this I found really interesting, is that the major reason for the projects was development or population growth. 60% of the projects entered in were for that reason. Next in line was for antiquated systems. We have pipes, wooden water pipes still in Oregon. We have pipes that have all kinds of problems, arsenic, other things that I'm not sure I want to know about. And then also state and federal regulation compliance. This shows the total cost by type. The largest amount was for transportation type projects, and then next was water and wastewater infrastructure. In terms of Senator Johnson, you asked about water and wastewater projects. This table here shows those projects that are needed within the next couple years. So we're trying to highlight those ones that really needed to be addressed right away. The total amount came to a little over $1 billion, with almost 80% of that needs to be financed by some kind of source, either state or federal. And the consequence of not providing the financing either means that the project doesn't get done and there's water systems that are in trouble or very, very high water sewer rates. Financing needs compared to total cost, again, this shows on the transportation and the water and wastewater infrastructure needed, and the yellow bar highlights what the financing costs that are needed. Of the region's top almost 130 projects, 129, those regional boards selected and ranked the projects. The criteria, again, was approved by the commission. However, I do want to add that the commission was not involved in the selection of those projects. And the total cost of those top 10 projects by region was $580 million. Of that, $375 million would require financing. And OECD financing, we looked at all the different sources we have available right now, Special Public Works, Community Development Block Grants, Safe Drinking Water. Over the next 3 years, we'd have about $213 million, which leaves a gap of $163 million. In summary, this is a snapshot of infrastructure projects. I hope that you'll find it valuable for doing, looking at budgeting and planning. The needs, no matter how you slice and dice it, far exceed our existing state resources. But I think without this infrastructure, it will be difficult to be able to have economic success because adequate infrastructure is so important for new business population growth. Our next steps will be to conduct additional analysis and then construct a program option package for recapitalization of the Special Public Works Fund.
Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair, that concludes the second report. In order to realize the time is escaping from all of us, and we had plenty of opportunities to have some discussion with you. Our third and final report is found in the yellow binder. This is the remaining of the budget notes. I won't call Mr. Grove up to make the presentation. What I'd just like to do is draw your attention, if I might, because of the lateness of the time. This is inclusive of all the other budget notes we're asked of this agency to...
Mr. Reeder?
Yes, Mr. Tricker.
May we all hold on going to the next until we acknowledge receipt of this particular portion of the report. Discussion. Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Given the lateness of the hour, I'll keep my remarks brief, but I would be remiss if I didn't thank the Commission, the agency, and its regional partners for the stellar work in preparing this report. It was a Herculean labor, and I appreciate all of the work that went into it, especially the work that Ann and her team put into it. Secondly, the receipt of this report is timely in that we are in the midst of a economic downturn, if not an outright recession. And there are basically three ways that our state can help spur business and job creation during this period. Infrastructure investment, improving access to capital, and ensuring a qualified workforce. And the regional investment boards are involved in all three of these areas. And I'm going to urge my colleagues in the next session to ensure that we take full advantage of their regional expertise. And by the same token, fully recapitalize the Special Public Works Fund to ensure that we have a critical, we meet our critical infrastructure needs going forward.
Okay, we're going to recess this item because we're going to lose a bunch of House members and perhaps some Senate members and get to the bill that we actually have to move at this point in time. That would be Senate Bill 1064. So we're going to recess the OECD reports. I apologize to those in front of us for the lateness of the hour and abundance of work to do. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 1064.
Chair and members of the committee, you had a presentation early in the public testimony that described this bill and the contents. The expenditure limitation involved, which is $210,019
Other funds for the remainder of 2007-09 will be placed in the budget bill, Senate Bill 5556, as will the position authority. And so all this committee needs to do is to move Senate Bill 1064A to the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
Any concerns with the fiscal statements? Yes.
I was prepared to offer a motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, good. Motion's in order.
Mr. Chair, I would move SB 1064A to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
As recommended by LFO.
As recommended by LFO.
Very good. Further discussion? Yes, Senator Litzie.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, and you're looking at how they're planning to fund these positions. Yeah, I wondered if they've taken into consideration that with the downturn in the economy, there are a lot less people working in the mortgage industry now. Not only a lot of jobs being lost, but a number of firms no longer in business. I wonder if they've taken that into consideration in their projection of not needing new funding until 2011.
Mr. Reisinger, would you like to address that question? Could you hear the question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Whitson, for the record, I'm Cory Reisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And the answer is yes, we have taken into account the shrinking of the industry. We have seen a drop-off in licensure, both for mortgage lenders as well as loan originators, and we have projected that in.
Thank you.
Good question. Yes, and
real quick, I wanted to add a comment. It did come out of our committee on a unanimous vote to this committee, just for the record. There was no dissent.
Good comment. Further discussion? The motion's been made. Objections? Seeing none, the motion carries.
Thank you,
members. Very good. Appreciate the House working with us on this. Maybe we get our friends from OECD to come back up. I'm sorry to interrupt them at the end of that portion of the report on the infrastructure for territories. Any other comments? Representative would give some very cogent comments. Any other comments? I have some, and I apologize for that. This is a big project. I really appreciate Representative Edwards, the extremely timely and good work you all have done. I guess the question I had is, out of that, your top 129 projects, how many of those fell into the medium priority versus high priority? Were those all in the high priority category that you've outlined?
I believe they're probably all or nearly all in the high priority category, because what we had asked the regional boards to do was to make their selection from the high priority category.
And I and follow up before myself would be, I assume there's about 10 per region. That was the original charge, as I understood.
That's correct.
But just a comment, as I look at, you know, we don't have a fund that has $500 million in it right now. And the reason we went through this exercise, hopefully a meaningful exercise, and make sure everyone's a part of this, is we're going to have to develop something. And as the governor's office, the legislature comes forward wanting new economic development dollars in a revolving fund or to augment the current revolving fund, one has some idea how that might be used. My comment, this is just myself talking, is that a lot of those in the medium priority, while very good projects and probably needing some funding, the community facilities ones, I think, would be difficult for the committee to rank above, like a sewer project or a rail project, these types of things. And I think in terms of looking at how we're going to improve economic development around the state being the charge of the agency and such, that might be something to consider as we look forward. And maybe there's others that totally disagree, but trying to confine our interest to things that we really, really, really need to do and that we can afford to do some things well, don't do all things bad, that type of discussion. Having said that, I appreciate the work you've done. Very, very good. Thank you very, very much. Further discussion? Anyone going to move that we acknowledge receipt of the report?
Mr. Co-Chair, I think we'll have to do that tomorrow. We are short of quorum on the House.
Okay.
Well, the official action will have to come tomorrow, but we'll acknowledge the good work.
Yeah, what a great job, man.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Co-Chair, that's two of the reports. We do have a final one that we're in the process of presenting to you. Again, without belaboring the time, because I know it's getting late, This is the remainder of the budget notes that were assigned to us from the 07 section. These are pretty much works in progress. So this is just a, for the lack of a better way to describe, this is a check-in report. If you were opening up the yellow binder, you'd find on the table of contents of the budget notes as they were stipulated in the budget note document that was forwarded given to us. On each page of the update and report, they're all measured under the same process so that we take them through, so there's the same filtering process, so there's consistency of how we're doing the assessments of each of these. These are ongoing reports that we'll be working on. The end product of this is to be able to use the information we collect from this to start building our 2009 request of the Legislative Assembly. So improvement of key performance measures, outcomes, all the things, accountability that you've been asking for, built into these budget notes. As you take the time to read those, you'll find that we've made some good advancements of processes to help report on projects as they move through for accountability. We're test driving some processes now on the return on investments, which I think is an important measurement you're looking for also. So much of this will still be in process, and we will report in JLAB committees when opportunities present themselves to update these remaining budget notes with you.
May have to come back in one of the future e-boards, perhaps.
We look forward to that.
I'm sure you do. Further discussion on the last budget note, reporting on performance goals.
Great.
Very good. Well, we'll defer action on that. Thank you so much for coming forward and the brevity of your last report. All right, we'll move on to some informational items. The Department of Transportation, report on activities related to minority contracting. Please come forward.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And with me is Michael Codd, my civil rights manager. Appreciate this opportunity. I will be brief. I'll tell you, Mr. Codd, we'll kind of follow up where I left the last time we spoke. And I laid before you, if you recall, the disparity study and the findings of those. And Mr. Codd will walk through the 17, or not all 17. He'll touch upon some and certainly accept any questions you have. Before we get there, I want to remind the committee that the disparity study was an extremely important document. It is one piece of a bigger discussion that we're having here. We remind the committee that while we will address the issues and the recommendations found in the report, we're also working on several different fronts. The front of growing apprenticeships, the small business, ensuring that we allow folks to come to the table and compete, whether it's a professional or the technical service side, right into construction. So we're dropping down the barriers and the obstacles that and the risks that are associated with smaller business coming to do work with the Oregon Department of Transportation. We're trying to grow mentor proteges. We understand folks want to get into this business.
Mr. Garrett, excuse me, just for, I apologize for interrupting. Can we just go right to the performance measure?
Yes, sir. With that, Mr. Cobb.
Good afternoon or good evening. My name is Michael Cobb. I'm the manager of the Office of Civil Rights with the Oregon Department of Transportation. To kind of just segue right into that really, really quickly, the bottom line is disparity studies come and go. We can do disparity studies. We can set hard goals. Once the hard goals have been set, federal requirements say that they have to have sundowning requirements, which means that after a set period of time, those hard goals that may have been set go away. So what we are approaching here is if we are really going to impact Oregon here in terms of increasing opportunities for small businesses, we need to grow them. So of those 17 recommendations, I'm just going to touch on just a couple of them, dealing with a couple of programs that I feel are exciting, and that's the small business contracting program that we implemented, two programs actually, one for A&E and the other one for on the construction side of the house.
Sure. I'm sorry, Senator Gore.
I really don't want to interrupt, but I need us to move
and I believe the co-chair is working on this, we need to move to the performance measures.
Okay.
And the specific recommendation in the report, it's recommendation 917 on page 6. When we last met, that's where we left off. We were talking about performance measures and acknowledging, recognizing that in order for the department to move forward in addressing the disparities, we're going to have some key performance measures. So that's where I want to draw your and focus your attention. And I want to ask you, if you are prepared now, Director Garrett, when I look at the response to the recommendation 917, which is that ODOT should add performance measures other than DDE percentage utilization. Some suggested measures come from Florida Department of Transportation Small Business Initiative, and then those are all laid out. Are there any on that list that you disagree with? Secondly, you say in your response that ODOT is considering adding this data to the annual year-end DBE report, and I just want to suggest that is not a strong enough commitment given the findings in the disparity study, and that what needs to happen, I believe that what we need to hear at this meeting is that there is a willingness on the part of the department to adopt the recommendation in 917. All points of that recommendation in 917, and if there are reasons why you feel that you can't go forward with any of those recommendations, then that's what we need to hear on the record. I just wanted to cut to the chase today.
Senator, I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordon, the bottom line is there's nothing I disagree with. As a matter of fact, I've highlighted some of the points articulated here because I think it does show that we are growing the opportunities for small business. So I embrace this. Now, I do have points that I think we should put forward because I think it gives that comprehensive picture. Whether it's all of them, I will tell you, I think we collect most of the data, so the information's there. What I would put forth is a key performance measure, or measures plural, I can grab at least four right now in front of me that I think will show that we are growing opportunities for all minorities. Now, Senator, that said, I think it's important that when you step back and you look at the findings of the disparity study, while it does articulate exposure for African American firms and Asian American firms specific to subcontracts, I will say overall it does portray the efforts of ODOT with DBEs as being good, positive, solid. And again, I don't want lost years. I'm trying to grow opportunities for all minorities here. Again, I think some of those points that you point to on page 6 here, we will share that information.
And if I may just
when you say you will share that information, what are you saying? Are you saying that is that a commitment to embrace and put in place these performance measures as key performance measures?
Chair Schrader, Senator Gordon, that's my commitment. You bet.
And if we had a quorum, Mr. Co-Chair, I would want to make a motion putting that into a record. We don't have that today, but we do have a commitment, a verbal commitment on the record.
Okay.
And that's the direction we need to move in.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Johnson?
Is the committee satisfied then at this point with the verbal commitment that we've got that we're going to be moving forward a little more significantly in this whole minority contracting issue?
And I would add, if I may, Mr. Co-Chair, that those key performance measures should show up in the ways and means process, in the budget-making process. That's what we're headed toward. And I just want that to be clear on the record as well. And I also want to honor the other good work that's going forward in the department. I don't want to diminish those gains at all or in any way diminish the leadership that's sitting right in front of us. What I do want is to put the pedal, to the pedal, thank you, Senator Winters, and deal with performance deficiencies as they exist.
Chairman, Senator, thank you. I appreciate what you've said, and please believe me, we are working
very hard on this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Let's see. Next item, informational hearing. Board of Clinical Social Workers, report on positions and fees. Staff want to open with any remarks? No? Please begin.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Schroeder, Terry Mullen, members of the committee. I'm John Langenwalter, the administrator for the State Board of Clinical Social Workers. I appreciate this opportunity to bring the committee up to speed on some very important issues that the board is facing right now. You do have a handout in front of you. I will cut to the chase. And I invite you to look at the second page of the cover letter, about halfway down. The board has found it in a challenging position right now to honor its primary mission of public protection. We are swamped. We have complaints, not only by number, but by complexity. And in order to honor that mission of resolving complaints fairly, thoroughly, professionally, and timely, we are at the point where we need to hire a compliance specialist. We've been talking about this for about 9 months now, and we were hoping to be able to wait until the 9/11 normal budget process to bring this to your attention. But because of the number of complaints, I have them all here, and the complexity of them, we are having to hire contract compliance specialists, and that's not in anybody's best interest. We're at the point now that we need to hire a full-time compliance specialist, too. We've talked to our stakeholders, the licensees in the field. We need a fee increase to do that. And the board is proposing to take care of this situation with the three actions listed in the middle of the second page. We're proposing to adopt a temporary rule either at the March or certainly no later than the April meeting to increase the annual renewal fee for licensed clinical social workers by $25 a year from $90 to $115. That still puts us very low in terms of the other professional licensing boards. We would also, in that same temporary rule, increase the application fee, and that's a one-time application fee from $100 to $150. Once again, that still puts us very low amongst the other health and related licensing boards. We would then come to the June e-board meeting with the board, with the committee's permission and request a limitation increase backdated to March and April when we would bring these positions on board because we don't have any flexibility in our current limitation to cover this. And then we would promulgate rules by July or August to permanently put into rule those fee increases. But I did need to bring you up to date on what's going on in the board and our need to more timely and professionally resolve complaints and protect consumers in that way. There's a lot of more information in the attachments and the fact sheets. If you have any questions, I'll gladly answer now or we're going to move ahead.
Questions? Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Has it occurred to the board to find out what the root cause of being swamped with complaints is rather than just adding more compliance and raising your fees this dramatically? There must be something systemic here.
Co-Chair Trader and Senator Johnson. In checking with the other health-related licensing boards, and especially the mental health-related licensing boards, they're experiencing similar kinds of dynamics. But we don't have a clue why consumers now, as opposed to last year or 2 years ago when it was really low for whatever reason, we have no idea why consumers now are submitting the complaints that they are and the complexity that they are. I don't know if consumers are more adept or informed that they can do this kind of thing, but the complaints not only increase in terms of number but complexity, and we don't know why, but we just need to respond. And
So far in this calendar year, we've had 9 complaints already coming to the board since January 1. So we're heading into setting another record that nobody wants. We can't stop it. You know, we're there to protect the public, and we don't know why the increase. I'm sorry.
Senator Winters and Senator
Wilson. Have you identified any patterns in complaints in specific areas that stand out more than others?
Yes. Co-Chair Schrader, Senator Winters. The biggest genre of complaint right now is from the child custody evaluation genre, and that has been for several years. The second biggest is the boundary issues, and that's not just sexual boundaries, but other kinds of boundary violations between a therapist and a client. And the rest are spread across the board.
So child custody is probably the biggest issue that generates the complaint.
Yes.
Follow up, Mr. And how much time does it take you to resolve those?
Co-Chair Schrader, Senator Winters, it really depends on the case. The board dismissed one at their meeting this past Saturday that it had taken 9 months to resolve. That was a very complex case that cited, if I remember right, 9 different violations, potential alleged violations of rule. And we had to look through all of those very carefully. Sometimes it's just a much simpler complaint that revolves around maybe 1 or 2 issues of rule. And it's much easier to get to the facts of the case and decide whether or not there was a rule violation or whether it can be dismissed. So it ranges all over the place. But what we have found in the last 3 years is that the time to resolve a complaint has been sneaking up on us. It was 2.5... The median average was 3.0 months in 2005, 3.5 months in 2006, and 4.0 months so far in 2007. But there's still some 2007 complaints that haven't been resolved, so that figure is going to change a little bit in the wrong way.
Are there times that some of the complaints that come in that you can look at them and that you know that they're statutory in nature and that it doesn't require follow-up? I'm looking at child custody cases.
Okay. Senator Schrader and Senator Winters, I'm not sure I understand your question. When it comes to a child custody case, the complainant will normally allege that the licensee didn't talk to everybody that was supposed to, you know, didn't do this or misrepresented this fact. The board then has to investigate, you know, who was talked to. We get the case record. We have to look at the billing issues. We have to look to see, did this happen or not? And if it did happen, is that a rule violation or statutory violation that we need to be concerned about?
Representative Jensen.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like my two colleagues from the Senate, I'm really concerned about the complaints. And I suppose I'm concerned about the cause, if there's any pattern involved. One of the things that strikes me as a possibility here is you're saying you have 53% growth in the last 2 biennium in the number of applications for it. And, you know, and that's fine, that's all right. You know, I guess that's good if we don't have all of the complaints that go with this increasing number of people in the field. And so I guess one of the things that I'm wondering about, you know, with this is as I recall, there's an internship that needs to go, that people need to go through before they become licensed clinical social workers. And I'm wondering if we have this increased number that you're talking about, if we have the adequate site residency or sites to be able to provide viable internships for them, or if it's something else. I just would be uncomfortable if we didn't have sufficient
sites to be able to deal with the number of applicants where people got the type of training that the profession would be telling us they should be getting. That's just an editorializing sort of thing on it, not necessarily looking for an answer, but just one person's concern about this as I look at it in the future.
Would you like some feedback?
Sure.
Okay. Co-Chair Schrader, Representative Jensen, that 53% increase is split pretty evenly, almost 50-50, between people who are already licensed in another jurisdiction and are moving to Oregon for whatever reason, and already have a license, and we acknowledge that. So they do not need the intern supervision. Okay, they're already licensed, they pass the test. The other half are people that do need to go through the two-year-plus kind of internship, and currently there are enough sites that are appropriately supervised to do that.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm recalling hearing from several different boards during the 07 session on the Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee about fees and number of licenses, number of investigations, number of complaints, and so forth. And I'm hoping that either through those people testifying today or through legislative fiscal office, we can hear how this compares to other licensed professionals. For example, when I look at the volume, hearing that there's a percentage increase, it sounds really alarming, but when you look at the raw numbers, it looks like a very small number. I see numbers like 29 and 31. So I'm wondering how the activity involved here compares to, this is clinical social workers, but I see there's also the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. That may be the closest comparison, maybe closer than, for example, Board of Dentistry or Board of Optometry, as an example, might the similarity in the kind of work and kind of activities. But how many complaints do we see per licensed professional from this area versus some of those other boards? I'm trying to put this into context. Is this still kind of on the low side, or is this a lot higher? I don't have numbers to help me see percentages, ratios, comparisons. The percentage sounds alarming, but looking at the raw numbers, it doesn't look alarming to me, so I'm trying to understand the need.
Okay. Co-Chair Schrader, Representative Nathanson, let me respond in two different ways. I can certainly get back with you. I do not have the figures from the Board of Psychological Examiners or the Board of Counselors and Therapists over the last several years like you have my data. I can certainly get that for you and respond so that you can see some of those. I did, in talking with my counterpart from Psych Examiners, find out that, and I'm bringing 208, and I'm still having trouble with that. Okay. In 206, their numbers were low for complaints, even as ours were. In 207, there was a huge increase. So far in 208, there's been an increase. We have no idea why, but both psych examiners and our board have experienced similar kinds of patterns. They are running a few more complaints than we are historically. They always have, but the exact numbers I don't know. We can also compare with the counselors and therapists. The three mental health licensing boards have very similar venues and very similar clientele. So to look at those together is very appropriate. In terms of looking at the raw numbers, you're right. They don't look overwhelming. However, they are overwhelming. The hours and hours and hours that go into a specific complaint resolution process, especially one that's very complex and one that might be going to hearing, is enormous. I'm spending over half of my time as administrator of the board focused only on consumer protection. There's also the impaired professional program. There's also the licensing issues. If, you know, I would love to give up half my job to this compliance specialist, too. And trust me, the members of the Consumer Protection Committee, the three board members, and these are all volunteers, as all board members are spending around 15 hours a month preparing for the meeting, and even then they're not really prepared. A compliance specialist, too, would be able to more timely and more professionally work through the process to everybody's benefit. So even though the numbers are small, they're staggering to those that are actually in the trenches doing the work.
Brief follow-up. So they're staggering in terms of the hours needed to do the appropriate preparation and get everything just right to make sure that we are protecting the public. I will look forward to, at a future time, seeing the comparison for how these other boards are doing and how long it's taking them to resolve complaints as well. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Just very quickly, colleagues. Following a little on Representative Nathanson's questions and concerns and my previous questions, have you looked at what should I call it, the newcomer versus the in-house candidates, the people in coming in, the new LCSW is coming in from outside of Oregon, or those who are educated and trained in Oregon, and whether there's any relationship here as far as your complaints are concerned? I still haven't made my question clear.
Well, Co-Chair Schrader, Representative Jensen, I think you have made your question clear, and no, we've not looked at that. It'll be very time intensive to go back and look at each complaint and then figure out, was that licensee originally went through the process here in Oregon, or did that licensee come in from someplace else? You know, I can get that down. I just have not.
Co-Chair, I think that might not be a bad measurement to have in the files, so when we look at their operation and measurements, to where the folks are coming from on this. I think we have a responsibility here. And I think we went through this kind of same issue with another one of the agencies last session that was time consuming and a lot of agony maybe on it. So I'd be interested in following this and see how it goes. And I certainly want to have assurances that, that we're minimizing these things and also that we're getting through the review of the complaints in a very rapid fashion. That's one of the things that will get the agency, I believe, in trouble faster than necessarily the number of complaints that you have. If we can't resolve the issues, then we are in trouble.
Right. If I could respond.
Okay, sir. Other questions?
I have several.
What's your current ending balance? How much ending balance do you have in terms of months of keeping going?
Co-Chair Schrader, I saw 164,850, which represents almost 5 months of operational expense.
Is that before or after the fee increases? Assumed fee increases.
That's before.
Before. And after, if the fee increases go into effect?
Okay, I might be misunderstanding your question. The fee increases would pay for the expenses and would not affect ending balance. What would come in would go out. We'll use on page attachment.
I assume the reason you're wanting to increase the fees is because you're running out of money, which means ending balance is small.
What we're suggesting, what the board is proposing, is using about $20,000, almost $21,000 of ending balance, so it can go down to 140, give or take, and then use the rest from the fee and application increase.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it's after the fee increase that you end up with that 5 month ending balance, is it?
Just about.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
What's the time between the? When was your last fee increase for your membership or?
2 years ago, we went from 75 to 90, and I want to provide history. In 99, we had a large ending balance, and the legislature instructed the board to reduce its fees. At that time, the renewal fee was $75, and it was reduced to $55. In 2001, the board came and requested that that be reinstated, and the legislature denied that request. In 2003, they requested that it be reinstated, so in 2003, we went from $55 to $75. In 2005, we went from $75 to $90, which is where we are now.
Yeah, obvious question, I guess, is number of fee increases every biennium. Is there any concern about reluctance of the membership to engage in that fee increase?
Senator Schrader, when we listed this on our website and requested response from our licensees, the majority of them understood and were definitely in favor of it. 36 raw numbers were in favor. 13 basically just had questions and didn't have an opinion either pro or con, and 13 were opposed no matter what.
It's like a lot of people in general. I guess I'm ignorant as to how many clinical social workers are currently like.
We have about 3,400 on our database.
You see my point. Not a very representative sampling.
It's huge, according to our normal take. We normally don't hear anything.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Congratulations, I guess.
Yes. We felt really great.
So I'm not real excited. Give me some reference. So when did the positions get hired, and when did the fee increases take effect? When do you receive the revenue?
Senator Schrader, the board's proposal is to start the compliance specialist to hopefully the 1st of April, the middle of April, in a month and a half. The earliest we could do a fee increase would be May, depending on whether or not we can timely do a temporary rule thing in March. If not, it would be April, and then it would be June before we could increase the fees.
So wouldn't you want to wait till you got the fee increase before you went ahead and hired the person? People.
Senator Schrader, no. It's covered by the ending balance, and then there's enough fee increase. Well, there's enough ending balance. The $20,000 will cover for several months. If we start paying the position in April, the middle of April, and actually get the money in either in the 1st of May or 1st of June, it won't be a problem.
If you get the money. I hope the other 3,260 people are okay with the increase. Last question, if I may, is performance measures. You list some problems that you have in terms of the complaints and the timelines, and I assume that your major performance measures to try and resolve those and get those reduced. Do you have targets that you're shooting for that this fee and these compliance specialists will get you towards?
Senator Schrader, the only performance measure that we have relating to complaint resolution is the number of public actions that we take against the licensee base in a given year. We don't have a measure on timeliness yet. We certainly could. Like all the other health-related licensing boards, we're supposed to complete the investigation with 120 days. You can extend that if need be. And that's where we're really hurting, is to complete the investigation in a timely manner. Once the investigation is complete, the board usually doesn't have too much trouble making up its mind what to do. But to get that investigation complete is very crucial.
Maybe we work with LFO and make sure we have the appropriate measures for the money that you're asking your members to pay for. Mm-hmm. Any other? Yes, Senator Johnson.
A couple of questions. Do you publish your agenda?
Co-Chair Schrader, Senator Johnson, yes, we do on both of them. Well, on the website. We don't mail it out to the licensees, but we do it on the website, and then we mail it to the normal newspaper, news media outlets.
Do you allow for public comment on your agenda?
Every month.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Dan, do you have a recommendation for us?
Sure. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Rachel Nolan, Budget and Management. We recommend acknowledgement of receipt of the report. And for the record, we also recommend that the board administratively raise fees between now and June and come before the June e-board to ask for a position authority and an increase in expenditure limitation.
LFO.
Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, LFO recommends receipt of the report and that the Board of Clinical Social Workers administratively increase their fees between now and June and then come back and report to the junior board and then request position authority.
Very good. That sounds a little more logical. Well, we're going to have to put off the final action because we obviously don't have a quorum. I apologize for that. You're very clear. You answer our questions, I think, very well. Appreciate that.
One parting gift question. What's Plan B?
Co-Chair Schrader, Senator Johnson, keep on doing the best we can. I'm sorry.
Social workers do that, don't they? Thank you for doing that. All right, well, I guess adjourn this meeting. We'll come back and take care of that in a future day, hopefully sometime in the next 24 week and a half. Thanks for taking the time. With that, I think we are done for the day. Adjourned.